धातु प्रवाह निर्देश So with all these natural decorations, he was so attractive that he appeared like a Natavation, like an actor going out to perform on stage. Anuvratam se. So Anuvrata means one who follows, Anuvaranite. So another friend, so Namjaputi said that friend was Subala. So his left hand was placed on the shoulder of Subala. So Krishna was having his childhood, boyhood pastimes, Amshi upon the shoulder. Vinyasta hastam. So his one hand was placed, Vinyasta is replaced on Subala's shoulder. And the other hand, Itarena, the other hand, what was he doing? Dhunanamabjam. He was twirling a lotus, you know, playing. Dhunanamabjam. Karanotpala alak, alak, alaka kapol. So, Karanotpala. Upon his ears, sometimes you see people, they put some flowers in their ears for beautiful decoration. So, Karanotpal, their lily, Utpal is lilies. So on his ear, there are lilies put over there. Alak Kapol. Kapol means cheeks. So his alak, his hair were extending down up to his cheek. Mukhabjahasam. Mukhabja. Mukha means face. Abja is lotus like face. Hasam is having a smile. So let us recite the words. If you cannot see Jamal, you can come here also. You can see in this one. If you are not able to see. Shyamam Hiranya Paridhim Vanamalya Barha.
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 हिरण्यपरिधिं वनमाल्यबर्हा
श्यामं हिरण्यपरिधिं वनमाल्यबर्हा
धातु प्रवालन कवेशमनुव्रतांसे
धातु प्रवालन कवेशमनुव्रतांसे
धातु प्रवालनटवेशमनुव्रतांसे
धातु प्रवालनटवेशमनुव्रतांसे
धातु प्रवालनटवेशमनुव्रतांसे
धातु प्रवालनटवेशमनुव्रतांसे
धातु प्रवालनटवेशमनुव्रतांसे
धातु प्रवालनटवेशमनुव्रतांसे
विन्यस्तहस्तमितरेण धुनानमब्जम्
विन्यस्तहस्तमितरेण धुनानमब्जम्
विन्यस्तहस्तमितरेण धुनानमब्जम्
विन्यस्तहस्तमितरेण धुनानमब्जम्
विन्यस्तहस्तमितरेण धुनानमब्जम्
विन्यस्तहस्तमितरेण धुनानमब्जम्
कर्णोत्पलालक कपोल मुखाब्जहासम्
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 हिरण्यपरिधिं वनमाल्यबर्हा
श्यामं हिरण्यपरिधिं वनमाल्यबर्हा
धातु प्रवालनटवेशमनुव्रतांसे
धातु प्रवालनटवेशमनुव्रतांसे
विन्यस्तहस्तमितरेण धुनानमब्जम्
विन्यस्तहस्तमितरेण धुनानमब्जम्
कर्णोत्पलालक कपोल मुखाब्जहासम्
कर्णोत्पलालक कपोल मुखाब्जहासम्
श्यामं हिरण्यपरिधिं वनमाल्यबर्हा
श्यामं हिरण्यपरिधिं वनमाल्यबर्हा
धातु प्रवालनटवेशमनुव्रतांसे
ధాతుకరాణ్యవేషమనూరదాంసే
విన్యస్తహస్తం ఇతరేణ ధునానమాబ్జం కర్ణోత్పలాలకపోలముఖాబ్జహాసం
కర్ణోత్పలాలకపోలముఖాబ్జహాసం. శ్యామం హిరణ్య పరిధిం వనమాల్యవరః ధాతు ప్రవాల నట వేషం
అనువ్రతాంసే
వినశ్యత్ హస్తం ఇతరేణ ధునాన అబ్జం కర్ణోపలాలక కపోల ముఖాబ్జహాసం.
Some of the beautiful pastimes of Krishna. as described in 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam and subsequently elaborated by our acharyas in their commentaries, in their retellings, and in their references while commenting on other books. So, in the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna describes various purposes for his appearance. Most Indians, or at least most Hindus, know the famous verse. Yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata abhyudhanam dharmasya tadatmanam srijamyaham. So, this was 4.7 and the next was 4.8. Paritranaya sadhunam vinashaya chatushkritam dharma samsthapanarthaya sambhavami yuge yuge. So these three verses, or these two verses, describe the twofold, the purpose why Krishna appears. So whenever there's a decline of religion, he appears. And what does he do when he appears? Three things he does. Paritranaya sadhunam, he relieves the devotees from their misery. Vinashaya chatushkritam, he delivers by destroying the demons. He doesn't destroy the demons. Even his destruction is for delivering them. So, vinashaya chatushkritam. And then, he also creates a system of dharma for future orderly administration of the world. Dharma samsthapanarthaya sambhavami yuge yuge. Now, these three purposes are important. But actually, even if the Lord maintains order in this world, still, this world is ultimately a place of misery. And no matter what we do, we cannot change that reality of this world. So whether we are devotees or non-devotees, we all have to grow old, we all have to get diseased, we all have to die. And the material attempt to try to make this world a happy place is doomed from the beginning. It's doomed from the beginning. Sometimes scientists say that we will try to make this world immortal, or we'll make life people immortal in the future. Now, Srila Prabhupada, in the Ishopanishad, in his purport to verse 14, explains that actually matter inevitably undergoes six changes. There is creation, then there is growth, reproduction, maintenance, deterioration and destruction. So, whenever there is life, then the matter through which that life is manifested, that will always undergo these six changes. So, a flower bud is created, then it grows, it blossoms into a beautiful flower. Then it reproduces, some buds, some seeds are transferred by bees or other insects, the pollination to some other flower, reproduction. And then against the elements of the weather, it tries to maintain itself. But in spite of the best efforts, eventually, as the day starts setting, or as time passes, it starts decaying. The deterioration. Finally, there is destruction. So, science tries to explain things in terms of their simplest components. So, physics tries to explain matter in terms of its building blocks. So we try to explain the behavior of matter in terms of atoms and molecules. Chemistry, which tries to deal with the behavior of matter when it interacts in its different forms. So that tries to explain those interactions in terms of physics. So physics tries to explain in terms of fundamental particles. Chemistry tries to explain in terms of physics. And science tries to apply this reductionistic approach to biology, where they try to explain life in terms of the laws of physics and chemistry. But science is baffled about one particular thing, that normal matter, for example, this desk is there. So there is creation and there is maintenance. It continues to exist for some time, and then there is destruction. So this matter actually has only three phases in its existence. So, this matter is made of the same building block as our body. Yet, our body undergoes six changes, and this undergoes three changes. So, why this difference? if everything could be explained in the physics and chemistry, this would be the same as this. The behavior of both of them should be the same. But no matter how much a technology can be advanced, you know, you cannot have a robo, a he robo and a she robo mating and producing a baby robo. Maybe that happens in science fiction movies, but that's what it stays. Right? You don't have a baby robo.
And
the mother robo comes and offers her breast, and the baby robo suckles the milk. No, these things can't happen.
So, even the best, if somebody gets a leg, somebody's hand gets fractured or has to be cut off, then sometimes now they take artificial hand. Or the artificial hand, you know, if somebody's hand is cut off at the age of 10, then he replaces the artificial hand. But after 4 years, his other hand will have grown. But the artificial hand will not have grown. So no matter how sophisticated technology we have, we cannot make the hand grow. We have to replace the hand. So growth, reproduction, and gradual deterioration, these are changes which we see in living matter, if we can use that word. So science is baffled about these six changes, and we can't stop it. We don't even understand the causes of these six changes, what to speak of stopping them. At least with respect to the movement of the planets, science claims to understand their motion. We say that it happens by gravity. But just by knowing the mechanism, can we stop the way the Earth is moving or the planets are moving? No, we can't. So, Stephen Hawking, one of the most prominent scientists, so he's been going around the world over the last 2-3 years. He's going and telling Srimad Bhagavat philosophy to people. This world is an extremely dangerous place. Earthquakes which may come up, there are floods which may take place, we are going to run out of food, we are going to run out of fuel, there is environment which is polluting, and of course there is a great spectacular danger that some asteroid or some comet may come speeding through the space and hit onto our Earth. And science has the theory that early dinosaurs were wiped out because of that. And Srila Prabhupada was asked about dinosaur. Prabhupada said that actually they have a dinosaur. In Bhagavatam we have a ghaso.
Agassi was also a huge serpent. So
the point is that there are always dangers in this world. So he's going around and telling that this world is an extremely dangerous place. And what is his solution? Just we have to get out of this world. Just we have to put all our funds into space research, into finding a celestial object, probably a planet or a satellite, which is habitable, and shifting the population of the Earth from here to there. So that life will continue. He's a top scientist and he's making a serious proposal. And several countries have come together to earmark huge quantities of funds for the space research. Of course, that is very, very far away. Actually, the struggle to get people to other planets itself is difficult. What to speak of transporting the whole civilization, making it habitable. But, although in one part he speaks how this world is dangerous, the other part he gets it completely wrong. That actually, the danger of this world will not be solved by going to another planet. Because even that planet is destructible. And more importantly, the problems of this world or problems of this planet are not caused by the planet. They are caused by us human beings living on the planet. So even if we succeed in going to the moon, you know, if we have the same consciousness that we have over here, we will succeed in polluting the moon. So that means there are two things. One is the unavoidable, unchangeable nature of this world. And this world is always a place of misery and destruction. A place of misery and destruction. So when the 21st century started, at that time on one side there was a lot of fear because of Y2K. The computer system might crash and the whole civilization might crash. Are all of you aware of Y2K? Or you were too young at that time? You know, all the computers, they had these dates, 93, 94, 95. And now when they made the computer system, they had not anticipated that in the future, the dates will require a 4-digit pattern, a 3-digit parameter. So they had feared that the computer system would crash. By Krishna's mercy, whatever. And that didn't happen. But the important thing was that time there was, although they had thinking a new millennium will bring up something wonderful, on the other hand they were fearing that the new millennium might bring up something dreadful. But eventually what happened was that the new millennium just continued life the way it was earlier. So one of our ISKCON leaders, Jayadvait Maharaj, was asked to give a talk on peace formula for the 21st century. It was from 1999-2000 early days. So he said, he started the lecture by saying, there is going to be no peace in the 21st century. There is going to be, the topic was peace formula for the 21st century. There is going to be no peace in the 21st century. There was no peace in the 20th century. There was no peace in the 10th century. There was no peace in the 5th century. There is no peace in the 25th century. There is no peace in the 30th century. There is no way that there can be peace in this material world. Because this world is a place of friction, conflict. Mamai vamsho jiva loke jiva bhuta sanatana manaha shashtani indriyani prakriti sthani karshati karshati. Everybody is struggling. You know, we have left Krishna, we have given up akarshan for Krishna, and we are having karshan in the material world. So instead of akarshan, we have karshan. Akarshan is attraction. Karshan is friction. So actually the solution to karshan is akarshan. The more we develop our akarshan, the more we develop our attraction for Krishna, the more we will find that the karshan, the friction in our lives will decrease. Because what is the cause of friction? There are two countries which want the same resources. And that's why they fight. For example, there's been war throughout history. Iran and Iraq are fighting for certain oil wells. Or earlier, USSR and USA were fighting for Cuba or for Vietnam. So basically, that is at a national level, at an individual level. Sometimes there are neighbors. And there are two people living in an apartment, and they have flats, and they have a common veranda. And they fight over this veranda. This veranda belongs to me. No, this veranda belongs to me. And they make their whole life miserable fighting for our veranda. And eventually both of them die. So, what causes this friction? This friction is at a familial level, at a social level, at a national level, at an international level. Now, if you read the Vedic literature, there are fights between the demons and demigods. It is there at interplanetary level also. So, this karshan is a fact of material existence. And what is the cause of karshan? When the soul thinks that external objects are my source of happiness, then because those external objects are limited in number, then there is fight among people for those external objects. So the fertile, rich land, either it's fertile for producing crops or it is rich in minerals, that sort of land, wherever it is on the earth, there is conflict. So when people think that external objects are the source of happiness, then they fight over those external objects. And because of that fight, there is karshan. So actually, if people keep pursuing pleasure externally, then they will keep wanting external objects for happiness. And as long as they want external objects for happiness, the fight in this material world will go on. Why? Because these external objects are always limited, whereas our desires are unlimited. They are ever increasing. That's why in the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna in the 14th chapter, in verses 15, 16, 17, he describes the effects of the different modes. So he says, Rajasas tu phalam dukkham. Rajasas means the mode of passion. So in the mode of passion, we hanker for external enjoyment. And when we hanker for external enjoyment, what is the phala? Rajasas tu phalam dukkham. Karmanah sukrutasyahu sattvikam nirmalam phalam. Rajasastu phalam dukkham, agyana tamasaha phalam. So So he says, when we act in ignorance, then we actually go into deeper ignorance. It's like a drunkard, he drinks and then he slips and falls into a gutter and he goes completely off. He's in his own world imagining and delusion things. He's acting in ignorance and the result is further ignorance. But when somebody acts in passion, the result is karshan, dukkham. Now what is the solution to this? The solution is, actually, we have to discover a source of happiness within our own hearts. Individually and collectively, this world can never become a happy place as long as people are looking for external happiness. So the only way this world can become somewhat peaceful is if we can find happiness within our own hearts. Certainly this world cannot become a peaceful place, but we can become peaceful in this world. We can become as peaceful as is possible in this material world. But for that, we have to change the direction of our search for happiness. It's not that we have to give up our search for happiness, we have to change the direction of our search for happiness. Instead of looking for happiness externally, we start looking for happiness internally. So, what is that internal search for happiness? It sounds very interesting. Okay, search for happiness internally. What does it mean?
First of all, how do we search internally? We've got a flashlight here. And what are we going to find in internal?
It's not as simple or literal as that. Internally means, you know, we have a gross body. Beyond that, we have a subtle body. Beyond that, we are ourselves souls. And next to the soul is Sarvasya Chaham Ridhisanjanishto, is the Supreme Lord. And that Supreme Lord is supremely beautiful. So this verse describes his beauty. It's one of the hundreds of verses in the scriptures which describe the beauty of that Supreme Lord. So we are all attracted by beauty. So a simple example of redirecting of our quest for happiness means that instead of seeking beauty externally, we start looking for the beauty internally. Now, that beautiful Lord is there in our heart, manifests externally as the deity. And he appears in this world personally also, to reveal his pastimes and to attract our hearts. So, that's why after 4.8 in the Bhagavad Gita, the Lord Krishna describes, I come to establish dharma. In 4.9, he describes a more confidential purpose. He tells, Janma karma cha me divyam evam yo vekti tatvataha yatva deham punar janma naiti mameti so Arjuna. Describes that Janma karma cha me divyam, that my appearance and my activities are divine, they are transcendental. Evam yo vekti tatvataha. If we can understand them in truth, then we will fall in love with Krishna. When we fall in love with Krishna, then our hearts are with Krishna. When our hearts are with Krishna, our bodies will follow and be with Krishna soon. We will return back to the spiritual world. So the real purpose that Krishna comes to this world is not to just create some order in this world. Because even the best order in this world will end in disorder. When Abraham Lincoln, he supported democracy in America, he said, democracy is a terrible form of government. But it is the best among all terrible forms of government. So, actually, in this world there are no good alternatives. There are only best among worst alternatives. Whatever we choose, there are no good alternatives in this world. Later on, when you go and take up jobs in companies, you will find that, okay, this company is a good package it is giving, and oh wonderful, maybe it will send me abroad and it will give me rapid promotion. But once you go into the company, you will find that probably your boss is very disagreeable, or the work demands are too much, or the expectations are too high, or something will go wrong. And then you choose some other company, go to some other company, and you find some other problem. And people always try to change. But you can never get any best option in this world. All that we can get is the best among worst. Just like sometimes when people want to get married, they spend so much time, especially because of this whole movie industry, people are in a dream world where they think, I will find my perfect partner. and they have the idea of a better half. The soul is om purnam adha purnam idam. The soul is not like a half which is another half. Krishna is purnam, and being a part of Krishna, we are also purnam. So, but what is required is for us to re-establish our relationship with Krishna, to realize our purnatva. Om purnam adha purnat purnam idam. Om purnam adha purnam idam. Purnat purnam udachyate. Purnasya purnam adaya purnam eva avashishyate. So everything that emanates from the purna is purna. But we have to learn to live in harmony with the purna. Then we experience our purnatva. Purnatva means completeness. So Prabhupada writes in the purport of this verse in Ishobhishan, all forms of incompleteness are experienced due to incomplete knowledge of the complete. All forms of incompleteness. We all feel something is missing in my life. And the advertisement makes us think that, oh, you don't have this mobile, you don't have this bike, you don't have this car. That's what is missing in your life. That's what we think is, oh, this is what is missing in my life. And I just have to get that. So, but Prabhupada explains that actually, what is it that is missing in our life? All forms of incompleteness are due to incomplete knowledge of the complete. The complete means the Supreme Lord. So incomplete knowledge means, people think, oh God, maybe He exists, maybe He doesn't exist. Or even if He exists, He is just an object of belief of some people. And maybe He's a desire fulfiller. But then sometimes he's a desire frustrator also. So maybe we will not worship him at all. So they don't understand that Krishna is the ultimate object of love for us. You know, when Prabhupada presented Krishna consciousness in the West, he presented Krishna not just as an object to as a person to approach, so that we would have our desires fulfilled. No, the Christians have this prayer. O Father, Thou art in heaven, hallowed be Thy name, give us our daily bread. So, Imam Sanskrit Prabhupada appreciated that at least because of Christianity, people go to the church and approach God. But Prabhupada said, when we approach God and ask for bread, that shows our love for bread, not love for God. So, actually, a devotee does not have to ask for bread from God. The example is given by Acharya, just like a baby. When a small baby is growing, the baby doesn't have to worry, oh, will my mother's breast produce milk or not tomorrow? No, he doesn't have to make any fire plan to make sure that there's a breast in the mother's milk in the mother's breast. Or even when he's growing, the infant doesn't have to worry as he's growing whether my parents will provide me food or not. All the child has to do is stay obedient to the parents. The parents will worry about providing everything. So like that, the Vedic scriptures tell us that Krishna is our father and Radharani is our mother. And Radharani expands as Bhudevi. Bhudevi is Mother Earth. So, Mother Earth is also our mother. So our parents will take care of providing for us. What we have to take care is, we don't run away from the home. And we don't become disobedient to our parents. As long as we stay obedient, we stay under their protection, we will be provided for. So, that's what the scriptures enjoy. That just learn to be in harmony and then you will experience your purnatva. But the whole modern propaganda is exactly the opposite. Modern propaganda is forget. Forget God. Neglect God. And try to acquire as much material enjoyment as possible. The modern material life can be described in three letters. WWS. What is WWS? Worldwide stupidity. That is, actually, sometimes you hear in companies there is one company takes over another company. It's a corporate takeover. So bigger company takes over a smaller company. Or sometimes there is a political takeover. In Africa it happens that one group of people is there, they overthrow the government, there's a political coup and they take over. So actually what we are experiencing in the world is a cultural takeover. The West, led by America, is taking over the whole world culturally. Culturally, it's taking over means that the Western culture is being accepted as the normal culture for everybody in the world. And what is this Western culture? Western culture is basically three activities. WWS. What is WWS? First is work. Work, work, work. And people work very hard. Earlier people, when they were in a agrarian based economy, they would work for maybe from morning to evening for 6-7 hours on the fields. Hard work. From now, when we work in our computer labs, if we appear, this is very soft and cozy. Whereas that work is very hard. But that is actually very good for the health. People work on the computer lab and then they have to go to gymnasiums. And they go to gymnasiums and they pay over there huge amount of money for maintaining their health. So, but naturally people would maintain their health. They would have to work for around 8 hours for a few months. First in the harvesting season and before that in the sowing season. And they would have enough produce for the full year. Then we advanced. We entered the industrial civilization. The industrial civilization, what happened? To work for 8 hours throughout the year. Because we had advanced. So you had to work more. Isn't it? And now we advanced further. Now we are from the industrial civilization, we have the information revolution. So because we have advanced more, so you have to work more. So now people work 10 hours, 12 hours. So first defining characteristics of modern work, work, work. People don't have time also for anything else. They don't have time. What to speak of God? They don't have time for their family members. Work, work, work. And then when they come back from work, they come home and sit in front of the idiot box. And the idiot box moves their minds further and makes them into further idiots. The second activity that they do is watch. 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 And they watch the television to get some relaxation from the strain, the tension, the frustration of their cup of his life, of their professional life. But what is the essence of the television? Now television is not run by social welfare workers who want to relieve you of your stress. Isn't it? It is run by greedy people who want to take the last paisa of the money that is there in your pocket. So in between all these entertaining programs. First of all, those entertaining programs are also such that they will mostly show high levels of wealth, opulence and enjoyment, which creates similar desires. But in between all these programs are the commercials. And every commercial is basically what? It's basically telling you, your watch is wrong. Your shoes are wrong. Your dress is wrong. Your hairstyle is wrong. Your face style is wrong. Your house is wrong. In fact, now there is a whole new business called death style. Because lifestyle, that is called death style. Now what is death style? It's ridiculous. Actually, before you die, you can design the coffin in which you will be buried. So there's an advertisement. It's a thought that it's become so common in India because the Indians bury the body. So it's not so common, but America it's very common. Death style is the latest lifestyle. So what is it? I'm going to die and the coffin is also going to get deteriorated. Nobody's going to come and see the coffin also, first of all. It's going to be the earth. And but, you know, you can have designer coffins. Now you can have whatever patterns you want to be engraved, what designs you want, what material you want. Choose your coffin and die in style. Actually, there is no dying in style. What is that? Earlier there was that advertisement. Live life, king size. So live life, king size, die rat size, and be reborn dog size. That's what this material existence is. So people try to enjoy this world and they die miserably. Like rats. And then because they are living animalistically, they will be born as dogs in the next life. So anyway, the second thing, so all these advertisements are basically telling us, what? Oh, shop, isn't it? This is, your hairstyle is wrong, your watch is wrong, your spectacles are wrong. So therefore, go to the shop and change it. That means, nowadays there are supermarkets. Now naive people think that supermarkets are so convenient. You can get everything at one place. You don't have to go to 100 places to purchase the different needs. At first glance it appears right. But actually, supermarkets are simply marketing super illusions. They are marketing super illusions. Why? Because you know, when we normally go to a grocer shop, at that time we have a list, and the items are kept inside the shop. Then the store we go, and then we give him the list. They read it out, and he gives the items to us. But when we go in a supermarket, then we go with a trolley. They're very intelligent. They won't just give you bags, trolleys, because they want you to purchase more and more. And then we may have our list, but along with that, we will see hundreds of items that you don't need to purchase. And they are all placed in such a way. At that time, there is a huge industry of this. You know, there are one of my friends in the advertising industry. So he said that actually, what kind of covers should be designed for those packets? And in the supermarkets, what sort of paint and color and aura and music should be there to induce desires in people's mind? So when we are walking to the supermarket, we see all these products which we don't need, which we didn't plan to purchase, but just by seeing them, dhyayato vishayan pumsaha sangasteshu pajayate. So what happens is, we get to contemplate on all these sense objects. And Lord Krishna describes 22.62. Once you start contemplating, what happens eventually? Buddhi nashat pranashyati. The intelligence gets destroyed, and people end up purchasing much, much more things more than what they need. And earlier, at least, how much money you had in the pocket was a problem. But now, with credit cards, even that problem is not there. So even if you don't carry much money, you carry a credit card. And then, the credit card is designed for what? Actually, to take practically all the money that is in your account. But the exploitation is so much that these people are not satisfied even with that. Then don't worry, if you don't have money, we'll give you loans. But you purchase. Why? Because actually when the WTC fell, the Twin Towers fell, you know what was the advice of George Bush to the whole American nation? It was not pray, it was not hope, it was not comfort each other, it was shock. Can you imagine? It's so ridiculous. The biggest disaster in American history has taken place in a war. Those of us who are in India, we probably can never understand what is the psychological impact of the fall of the Twin Towers. The America had built up a huge civilization with the illusion of comfort and security based on their material advance. And the Twin Towers symbolized that comfort and security. And when the Twin Towers fell, with that exploded, crumbled the illusion of comfort and security that they had. That's why it was devastating to the American psyche. At that time, for the first time for a few hours since the start of the internet, first time on the search items in Google, for a short time, God came above sex. But what was George Bush's solution? To shop. Why shop at such a time? It was not to give charity to those who are the victims of those people. Why? Because the whole economy as we have runs by shopping. And this is a very dangerous way to run an economy. Because traditionally, when the economy would run, based on renewable resources. Renewable resources means the main market, would be the main object that would be selling with the necessities of life. The food grains, the vegetables, the fruits. These are what we need to live. And these are renewable. So if all the people are employed for this purpose, then every year they will be getting new grains will be growing, new fruits will be growing, and they will be sold and they will be transported, and people will earn their living, people will get their food. So if people are employed in these industries, then there is gainful engagement for the whole society, which is sustainable. Why? Because every year crops will grow new. But nowadays, most of the people are not employed in farming. They are employed in industries which are basically consumer industries. They are meant for luxuries. For example, now if somebody joins a mechanical company, say Mahindra and Mahindra, they are producing vehicles. Originally Jeeps and other subjects always are producing. So when they are producing these vehicles, you see the number of vehicles that can be produced, or rather that can be purchased by people, are limited. Why are they limited?
because the number of people who have the financial power to purchase them are limited. So when the market gets saturated with too many of these vehicles and there are not enough people to purchase those vehicles, so what happens? What happens is that the whole industry will close down. And they don't want the industry to close down. So what do they do is, just keep producing new models. You know, you have a bike with this particular model and make some changes in that and have this model. And have that model. That model. Now you see, especially you see these changes in mobiles. Now there are hundreds of models and they always keep coming with some feature. And one of my friends, he decided that he's not a devotee. He said that I will find out one model, one mobile model which has all the features. And he started off. And for 1 year he was just doing research. And at the end of it, he found one mobile which had all the features. But when he got the mobile, by that time some other mobile had come which had better features. So the way it is designed is that actually the modern economy runs on the production of, on the production and sale of unnecessaries. Modern economy runs by the production and the sale of unnecessaries. And because unnecessaries means, okay, we may say in the modern times we need a mobile. But the mobile, even if it is a necessity, okay, one brand is enough. Ultimately, the main purpose of a mobile is to talk with you. Now, on that topic, you can have a video camera, you can have a speaker, and these things, you can have hundreds of things can be added. But basically, it's not that somebody is going to die because if they are not, those things are not there. So, because most people today are employed in industries that are catering to unnecessities, to luxuries. So what happens? It's vital that people purchase. Because for people, these things are not necessary to purchase. And that's why the advertising industry is as important, if not more important, than the production industry. But the problem with this is, that first of all, not only are people cheated of their money to purchase things which are unnecessary, but the earth cannot produce, keep producing these things permanently. Like we are saying, oil is only one of the most prominent of the resources that are soon going to run out. But metals, originally we used to use wood for fuel, and wood keeps growing as trees. But when we use coal and LPG and other things, they are not going to grow. So it's going to lead to a disaster sooner or later. But the main point is that the whole modern media is based on shop, shop, shop. Why shop? Because if you don't shop, then we will be hungry. If you shop, you will be hungry. We are not worried about that. We are worried about ourselves. So people just get bankrupt and people get fleeced. Fleeced means cheated. So work, watch, shop. This is what Western civilization is. WWS. That's the worldwide stupidity. Work, watch, shop. And actually, practically speaking, wherever Western culture has come, sociological surveys have shown that people spend their leisure time. Leisure time is defined as the non-working time. Their leisure time in two main activities, watching television and shopping. Actually, even their family, leave alone God, even their family gets second attention after TV. You know, there are couples who have actually gone to court and divorced because both of them wanted to watch different programs on the television. And the fight started from there. And it just grew. So of course now they have a simple solution. They have two televisions. No problem. But then after that, you know, you have their children. So every child needs his own television. And the companies are very happy because they are producing more television. They are selling more televisions. But it's like a trap in which people get sucked in completely. Just work very hard, watch television, purchase things. And what happens? This is a self-fueling cycle. When we shop and purchase things, they don't come free. So because they don't come free, we have to pay for them. And because of that, we have to work more. And when we work more, then we come back more tired home and then we want to watch TV more. And we watch TV more, there are more advertisements which you see, and then we shop more. So just the ever tightening circle. As Krishna says, you know, Asha Pasha Shatair Baddha Kama Krodha Parayana Ihande Kama Bhogartha Anyayena Atma Sanchayan. In the 16th chapter, 11th verse, Lord Krishna describes how demoniacally minded people are entangled by material desire. This is asha, pasha, asha, pasha. Desire is like a noose. Noose that catches us and drags us. Asha, pasha, shatair baddha. Shatair means hundreds. Hundreds. Hundreds of people are bound by, baddha is bound. People are bound by hundreds of desires. And kama krodha parayana. They're bound to lust. And when the lust is frustrated, they become bound by anger. Kama krodha parayana. And soon, ihante kama bhogartham anyayena sanchitam. Anyaya. And then since they start with anyaya, they become immoral. They become corrupt. They become degraded. And eventually they even become violent. So, actually, I started this whole discussion by saying how, you know, we have to turn our direction for happiness from external to internal. Modern society actually aggravates our external search for happiness. But it is a vain search. It is a futile search. You know, sense enjoyment, a soul seeking sense enjoyment is like a frog seeking shelter under the fangs of a snake. You know, if a frog seeks shelter under the fangs of a snake, what is going to happen? There's a hot sun everywhere. Anything, under the snake's fangs, there's such shade, there's no more heat. What is going to happen? Yes, there will be no more heat. After some time, there will be no more frog. So, like that, the conditioned soul trying to seek shelter in sense enjoyment. Like that, he's suffering because of all his material desires. And then he thinks, if I just do sense enjoyment, there's so much relief. But what is that relief? It's actually he's sleeping in the lap of Maya. And what happens? Maya catches and crushes him. That's why Bhaktivinoda Thakur, whose appearance day we are celebrating today, he thinks, Jeeva Jango, Jeeva Jango, Gaura Chand Bole, Kota Nidra Jao Maya, Pishachir Kole. Kota Nidra Jao Maya. And you know, what kind of sleep is this? You are being killed and you are peacefully sleeping. Wake up! The Upanishad says, Uttishtata Jagrata Prapyavaram Nibodhata. Awaken, arise, and there's a great blessing awaiting you. Grab that blessing and enrich yourself. Prapya Varam Nibodhata. Varam means blessing. Prapya. It is obtainable for you. Nibodhata. Understand what is that blessing that can be obtained. So, if we turn inwards, turning inwards means connecting with Krishna. So, we see that all of us, when we lead our lives are based on hope for the future. The Bible defines faith as the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of objects not seen. What is faith? The substance of things hoped for, the evidence of objects not seen. That means, if you see, this is not just a definition that applies to religion. Everybody lives by faith and hope. Now all of you are studying. That is with the faith and the hope that you will have a bright career ahead. People are working so hard to go to America. You know, Lord of Ganesh is considered to be Vigna Nashak. That's why it's called Vinashak, Vinayak, you know. Vinayak. So people think that he will remove the obstacles. So we are going to Chennai from here, from this part of this. Chennai, there is a special Visa Ganesh temple. What is this Visa Ganesh? And, oh Lord Ganesh, you are the remover of obstacles. I want to go to the dreamland of America and there are so many obstacles. The main obstacle is the visa department. So please, remove that obstacle. That's why he's called as Visa Ganesh. So this is a perfect example of abuse of religion.
For mundane purposes.
But the idea is that these people, they work so hard to somehow try to go to America. And they have hope that by going to America, I'll be happy. But the nature of material life is that one cannot become happy. Material life, no matter how much we achieve, we cannot become happy. In Pune, we have one devotee who came back from America. He was in America, he was very successful.
he went to like a dream career he had. From India he went to America and he stayed there for 10-12 years. And there he was introduced to Krishna consciousness. And then he had one daughter and he was sending the daughter to school, and there at the age of 6 or 7 they start sex education for children. And he told them, you know, actually this is 7-year-old, 8-year-old, you know, what can you do sex education with them? And then he told that, you know, this is not a, he went to them at the principal of the college and said that it's not, they not only have sex education but they have compulsory sex education. They said that you have to have this, and they tell practically all the details. So he went and met the principal, and he told him, it's not our culture that at such a young age we expose children to all this. And the principal just pulled up some charts, opened the computer. So I said, you know, if you don't get new sex education children, the children do worse things than if you give sex education to them. Therefore, this is compulsory, this is necessary, you can't avoid it. And somehow he decided that I'll not send my daughter to school on that day. And he didn't send. And he, you know, got a doctor certificate, something that she is sick or something. But then he didn't anticipate what happened. Because what happened was, she did attend the seminar first hand, but all the other children are going to stay quiet. So now she attended the seminar second hand. And what they told was even more twisted and even more distorted. You know, for most Indians, when they see half-naked images of women, most Indian youth, it's titillating to senses. But many of us don't think that, you know, just as we are demoniacally feasting our eyes on those forms, there are other people who will be feasting their eyes similarly on our mothers, our sisters, our wives, in the future when we get married, we have children, our daughters. And that is too horrendous to contemplate. But that is the inevitable consequence. You know, we cannot have one side of the coin. If we want to be enjoyers of other women, other people will want to be enjoyers of our women. And that is the culture. It's a dog-eat-dog culture. So when, you know, his small daughter, 8-year-old daughter, 7-8-year-old daughter, she's coming and talking about all these things, then he decided, I cannot stay in America. So for the sake of his children, he came back from America. We had a bright career there, but left it. Now, of course, because he was very talented, he's got a good career here also. Thing is, he said, my American dream was perfect when I went there, and as I went up the career chart. But actually, because he was a career-oriented person, so he was focused, he did not get so degraded. Not because he was spiritual at that time, but because he focused on the career. But he saw the effect that was having my children completely getting devastated. So he came back. Many Americans now want to come back to India. Many Indian Americans. You know, these are people, Indian government is welcoming them now. They're called NRIs, non-resident Indians. They are welcoming them back here. And please come back and give your money to us so that we can develop this country. They may give their money, but they are coming back. Why? Because in India has some semblance of culture. So these NRIs are coming back, but more than the NRIs are coming back, we have another species of people in India who are called RNIs. You know what is RNI? Resident non-Indians. They are residing in India, but everything about them is Western. their dress is Western, their desires are Western, their ambitions are Western, everything is Western.
So,
one of our devotees in Mumbai, he's a very senior devotee now. When he was born in a Vaishnava family, but he felt that all this Vaishnavism is superficial. And then after that, he was introduced to ISKCON. I was very inspired to see the devotees, foreign devotees, and then Indian devotees also he saw. And then he became dedicated and he decided to take initiation. So he decided to take initiation from an American body devotee. He decided to take initiation from Radhanath Maharaj over there. So at that time, his whole family exploded. He said, you know, you are an Indian, you are born in the Vaishnava family, how can you take initiation from America? His uncle came to him. His uncle was quite. He had some religious aura around him. He had built a temple and things like that. He said, you know, don't disgrace our family. He said that, how are you going to take initiation from America? You think these Americans will teach us our culture to us? We can appreciate that they are taking. We should encourage them, not seek guidance from them. Oh, you are also doing good. You are following our culture. We should encourage them. Not that we need their guidance. So, he gave a beautiful reply. He said,
you know, I have seen this person, Raghunath Maharaj, for the last 10 years. And there is nothing American about him. There is nothing American about him. In fact, I see more things American about you than about him.
And it's true, you know, people's dress, people's hairstyle, people's home style, people's desires, they are very American.
So these are all resident non-Indians. So what happens is, even the materialistic people are living by faith, by hope, that in the future their life will become better. And all hopes, all faith comes from some external promises. So materialistic people live their lives based on the promises given by other materialistic people. What are the promises of the other materialistic people? Oh, you earn money, you get a big house, you get a beautiful wife, you go to America, and you'll become happy. The promise. And this is the promise that is fueling the lives of most people. But unfortunately, it's a false promise. It's nothing. The advertisements are nothing but lies, bigger lies, and still bigger lies. Nothing more than that. Unfortunately, we take these false promises so seriously. On the other hand, when Krishna comes and tells us, you just become my devotee and I will take you back home and you will be forever happy with me, immediately we come down. Did this really happen? Does Krishna really exist? Does his abode exist? Can I really practice and become a devotee? How can I give up all my material desires? It's not possible. So unfortunately, there was a French philosopher, he said, the problem with the world is that the foolish are confident and the wise are doubtful. The foolish are confident. The materialistic people are foolish. They are thinking, oh, if I just get a new mobile, I'll be happy. If I just get a new bike, I'll be happy. That's foolish. But they are confident. If I just get this, I will become happy. And when I was in college, I could see some of my friends. Before I was introduced to ISKCON, I was also in that rat race. I had to go to America. Not so much, but I was there. So I could see how my friends used to work so hard. You can't imagine how hard they work. Day and night. So how are they working? Because they have that hope that if I go to America, I'll be happy. Now there is a problem with the rat race. You know, I was like the national topper in GRE. And I was a topper in the history of my college. But then after that, I was very happy for some time. Then I realized after that, what happens? Now you have another exam coming up. And now because you are topped in one exam, the pressure on you to top in the next exam is more. And then you top in the next exam and the pressure to top on the next exam will be even more. And then if you don't top in one exam, it is like a disaster. So of course, devotee is not against working hard, but the idea that this is what happiness is all about, I felt this is just bogus. So then later on I thought very brilliantly, so the problem with the rat race is that even if you win the rat race, you still remain a rat. That means what? You know, you come first in one exam, but still you just remain one of the competing rats. You have to compete for the next exam, and then the next exam, and the next exam. Things don't really change in material life. So, even if you win the rat race, we still remain rats. So, actually I could see this friend, they're working so hard in their material life, struggling, fighting, foaming at the mouth, somehow to go to America, and they think they will make it, they'll become happy, but they don't. They don't become happy. Some of those friends are now becoming devoted, and they're telling, you know, they married a girl who's turned out to be a drunkard now. One of them, you know, in India you can't imagine the husband becoming a drunkard one person, but the wife becoming a drunkard is a little too much. So another of them, he had daughter, and the daughter is, I mean, she's small, but she's already having some sort of sexual deviations and things like that. So it's like a disaster. So people are so confident about their false promises, and they're so doubtful about the true promises. So as devotees, we are wise. We have seen, at least partially, we have seen through the false promises of Maya. That's why we have come to Krishna at this point. But unfortunately, still we have doubts. The problem with the world is that the foolish are confident, and the wise are doubtful. The wise are doubtful. Now we doubt, if I practice Krishna consciousness, will I really become happy? So Krishna does all that he can to remove our doubts. And one of the things that he does out of his great mercy is he comes himself into this world. We may not believe that there is a spiritual world where there can be eternal happiness. When Krishna comes into this world and he reveals that spiritual world to us. When he reveals that spiritual world to us, then we understand, oh, how much sweetness, how much beauty, how much love, how much happiness is there in the reciprocation with Krishna. And that charms and attracts our hearts. In all the religions of the world, there is talk about God. But it may also be said that God is love. But how God is love, that is not described. So the Leela or the pastimes of God are the unique revelation in the Vedic literature. Not the Bible, not the Quran, or no other literature have anything similar to Leela. And they have nothing like that. In the biblical literature, they have the idea that God is in heaven. And then they have this famous picture made by Michelangelo. That Michelangelo was told to sculpt a picture on the Sistine Chapel. Sistine Chapel is a famous church in Europe. So he was a painter, but he was told to do a sculpting. He was a good sculptor also. So on the roof of that church, he has made various sculptures about God's mercy on man, as told in the Old Testament and partially in the New Testament through Jesus. So one of the images is God stretching out his hand and he's handing out his grace to man. And Michelangelo would depict man as Adam. Adam is the old man, the original man. So he's Adam. So then he would depict Adam as a very young, handsome, muscular man. So that Adam was there. Adam was stretching out his hand to reach out to God. And then, at that time, he finished that part of the sculpture, and then he had to depict God stretching out his hand. And then he wondered, how does God look like? And he asked the local bishop. The bishop had no idea. And he went up in the church ecclesiastical order till up to the Pope. And nobody had any idea of how God looked like. And finally he speculated. And he made God like an old man with a beard and looking very grave. And that old man is stretching out his hand to give his mercy to Adam. Now honestly, actually I was asked to go to the Sunday Christian Chowpatty, so I have a PowerPoint also, maybe in the picture I can show it to you. So there is a picture. There is Adam and there is God. And ironically enough, actually Adam looks more attractive than God. You know, man looks more attractive than God. Now obviously that is not correct. But he made God like an old man because he thought that God is the oldest person. He's the oldest person, therefore he must be old. But the various scriptures explain that God is certainly the oldest person, but he is not under the influence of time. And because he's not under the influence of time, rather time is under his influence. Like some people ask this typical atheistic question. If God created everything, who created God? So on Radhashram, my new book was released, Frequently Unanswered Questions. So in that book I answer this question. So there are different ways of answering this question. One way is that to understand that if you read a novel. So some of you may have heard of the Chetan Bhagat. His novels are very famous among the children. So now he's coming to our Chowpatty temple regularly. He's becoming a devotee. He met Radhanath Maharaj. And what was his latest novel? Three Idiots. That was based on
Three Idiots.
So basically somebody took this whole storyline and made a movie out of it. And they did not give him any credit for it. So he was completely devastated by that. At that time. So he came and met Radhanath Maharaj. And when he met Radhanath Maharaj gave him some guidance. So he writes very beautifully. So he wrote about it on his blog also. So Maharaj told him that, you know, there are two kinds of people in this world. You know, one kind of, this is very beautifully based on Bhagavad Gita 2.70. So he says that some people's hearts are like puddles. And some people's hearts are like oceans. So now, what is the difference between a puddle and an ocean? A puddle
you know, puddle, like what happens in the rainy season, a small depression is there in the earth and that gets filled with water. So like a puddle, then if in a puddle a wave of water comes in from somewhere, the whole puddle gets devastated, it starts overflowing. So like that, those people's hearts are like puddles. That means in their heart there is very little internal happiness. So that any external stimulus comes in, which is either pleasurable or not pleasurable, it devastates over there. On the other hand, somebody's heart is like an ocean. Then, but what does that mean? Now Krishna is called as Prema Sagar. He's the Ananda Sagar. So if Krishna is present in the heart, then the heart is like an ocean. In an ocean, even in an ocean, a river comes in. A wave of water comes in, the river comes in, nothing happens. So, like that, as long as our hearts are like puddles, that means we have very little internal happiness, most of our happiness is from external sources, then the waves of happiness, the waves of pleasure and pain will come and devastate our hearts. But on the other hand, if we connect ourselves with God, how, it's not as a sentimental act connecting with God. Connect ourselves with God through constructive service to Him. Means we are living our life in a way, whatever talents God has given me, I will use them for His service. But then, Krishna who is present in our heart reveals Himself. And then when He reveals Himself, our heart becomes like an ocean. So when our heart becomes like an ocean, then even if the waves of worldly success or worldly failure, worldly honor or worldly dishonor, they come in, they do not shake us. But otherwise, you know, we may write bestseller novels. But even after writing a bestseller novel, you know, somebody will come and steal the copyright. And they just whistle, you are miserable. You know, and I met him. You know, one of my books was given to him, so he liked some sections in the book. So we were discussing. I could see he was so frustrated by that. And at that time, he started chanting. He said, I am feeling a little better. When we become the writer of a bestseller novel, when we become actually national or international fame. But if the heart is like a puddle, then worldly honor and worldly dishonor will devastate the person. On the other hand, a person may be unknown to the world, but if he is connected with Krishna, his heart will be satisfied. You know, once his old Jayadvaita Maharaj, one devotee asked him, Maharaj, you know, you have been practicing Krishna consciousness for 35, 40 years now. So what gives you faith to practice Krishna consciousness? So Maharaj said that when I go to Vrindavan, you know, I see an old brahmachari over there. He serves Charanamrita. And he said, I have seen him serving Charanamrita over there for the last 31 years. And that's what he's been doing for the last 31 years. And when I look in his eyes, I see the joy in his heart. And he says, he's not getting any fame, he doesn't have any followers, he doesn't have any money. For 31 years, he has been worshipping Radha Krishna in Vrindavan. And he is serving Charanam, he is satisfied. Why? Because he is connected with Krishna in his heart. Once your heart becomes an ocean, even if the world doesn't know us, we will be happy. On the other hand, if our heart is like a puddle, even if the world knows us, the world will know us as a miserable person. You know, what is the use? You know, Michael Jackson, the most famous person in world history. But he was so unhappy basically, and eventually died such an unfortunate death. So, this worldly success itself doesn't lead to happiness. A devotee is not against worldly success, he is not against worldly prosperity. But he knows that this is not what will make me happy. What will make me happy is my connection with Krishna. If I have that connection, then even if I have worldly success or I don't have worldly success, it doesn't really matter. If I don't have that success, if I don't have that inner connection with Krishna, that bhakti for Krishna, and whatever else I have, it is useless. It will not make me happy. So, Krishna, when he comes to this world, he comes to reveal his beauty, his love to us. And to the extent we become attracted to him, to that extent we become happy. So I was telling about how this revelation of Leela is unique in the Vedic literature. So Michelangelo, he sculpted God, but he couldn't sculpt God attractively because God is outside the time domain. So, you know, if somebody asks this question, God created everything, who created God? So the answer is that
if somebody writes a novel, in that connection I was telling about Chidambaram. Somebody writes a novel, and novel has a storyline, it has its timeline, it has its characters. Now somebody, a small child reads the whole novel, and then he comes to know this novel is written by someone. Then he asks, oh, but where is the author in the novel? No, the author is not in the novel, the author is independent of the novel. Why? The author created the storyline, the author created the timeline, the author created the character, but he is independent of it. So like that, Krishna has created this world, he has created matter, he has created space, he has actually given all of us material bodies so that we can do our roles, our dramas in the material world. But he is separate from it. So when we ask, where is Krishna in this material world? Who created Krishna? The very fact that we are asking who created Krishna, that means we are thinking of Krishna as a product of this material world. Because time exists in this material world. Krishna exists beyond time. So when Krishna exists beyond time, then there is no question of his being created by anyone. He is eternal. He is eternal. And time is created by him. So because time is created by him, once time is created, once the storyline is created, for example, the storyline has a particular storyline in the novel has a particular timeline. Okay, it may be 1857 to 1912. That's the storyline of a particular novel. Now, if you see, is the author there in that storyline? No, author is independent of it. So like that, the timeline for this world is created by Krishna, but Krishna is separate from it. So, Krishna is not affected by time. Adyam Purana Purusham Navayauvanam Cha. He is Adyam. He is certainly the oldest person. That Michelangelo got right. Purana Purusham. He is the oldest person. That also he got right. Navayauvanam Cha. Navayauvanam. But he is eternally youthful. He is not affected by that. That the biblical literature could not tell us. So, we respect the fact that Jesus came and helped people raise their levels of God consciousness, but it is a fact, objectively analyzed, that the Bible doesn't give as much information about God. And that's why when these Christian missionaries convert people to their religion just for the sake of, by giving them some money, tell them, you just become Christian and then we will give you a job, we will give you some, we will feed your poor children, or we will provide medicines for them. You know, actually, they were such a, that is a disaster, cultural disaster. Why? Because if they just turn into Christianity and search for God, that is not a problem. But when they become converted to Christians, they become, or they are made by the propaganda, into haters of Vedic culture. You know, as devotees, we have a very broad attitude. We understand that the one God whom Christians call Jehovah, or Yahweh, or Muslims call Allah, that same God we call as Krishna. But the Christians and Muslims don't feel like that. Their idea is that there is only one God, the God who is taught about in their religion. And the gods talked about in all of the religions are the forms taken by the devil to attract people away from the one God. That's why you see many Christian Muslims, they don't take prasad. Why? Because they think it is not God's prasad, it is the devil's prasad. They think that worship of any God other than Allah or Jehovah is worship of the devil. And that's why when Muslims came to India, they destroyed so many temples. And now this whole the Ayodhya Babri Masjid controversy was there because the temples were destroyed in the past. So we don't want to get into politics. But the fact is that the Vedic culture is the most glorious culture. Not because we are born in India and it is our culture, but because Krishna has revealed himself the most profusely over here. And instead of, because we don't preach Krishna consciousness, so what happens? For ignorant people, whoever speaks something influential, they get attracted. So, because Indians are not taking responsibility of preaching Krishna consciousness, so what is happening is, Indian culture has been destroyed. Now in the Islamic tradition also, there is not much description of God. So the Muslim terrorists, you know, in Pakistan, there are so many madrasas. Madrasas are like, they are something like mosques, but they are not mosques. They are training people for young children. They train in hatred and terrorism to become machines of death for others. And what is their hope? What is their dream? There are some Quran verses are distorted to tell them that if you lay down your life for Allah, then Allah will reward you with 73 virgins in Jannat, whom you can enjoy for the rest of eternity.
it is not love for Allah, it is love for those virgins. And then you ask these Muslims, okay, you will enjoy with those virgins in Jannah, but what will Allah do? You know, Allah just has to be the caretaker of those virgins so that the jihadis can enjoy them. No, we don't want to sound offensive, but think about it. These people don't think about it. If you read the Quran carefully, one of Yazwan is called devotee, or rather, he was earlier a Muslim. He has now become a Hare Krishna devotee, Airavat Prabhu. So he's written a beautiful book, The Hidden Treasure of Al Quran. So in that book, he describes how actually, in that and several other books also, he describes that there are seven jannats described in the Quran. And about the topmost jannat is Jannat-e Allah, where Allah resides. So these jihadis, suddenly they're not going to that Jannat-e Allah, they're not going to any jannat. If they are killing people like this. But the point is that religion does not describe much about God at all. So of course, these devotees who tell that they were Muslims earlier and they have become Hindus now, they have to flee for their lives. Because in the Islamic religion, they have what is called apostasy. Apostasy means that the sin of giving up Allah and Muhammad. And they say it is such an unpardonable sin that the only punishment for that is death. So anybody who converts from Islam to any other religion, that person can never reveal his identity. Otherwise, he will have no more existence. So often these people change their name and that's how they live. So anyway, that is not what actually the original spirit of the teachings of Muhammad were, but they have been distorted. So the important point here is that because of the narrow-mindedness of the followers of these religions and because of the limited revelation that is there in the original scriptures, although they may talk about God as a God of love, there is not much description of how God is a God of love. So the Leela is a unique revelation of the Vedic literature where it describes how Krishna reciprocates love with his devotees in his own kingdom. So the Leela is something like a drama. Now the word drama cannot be used because drama connotates the idea of something unreal, something false, something temporarily staged. One of our ISKCON devotee scholars, Graham Shwee Garuda Prabhu, he has done his PhD in the Krishna Leela, especially in the Ras Leela. The Ras Leela Panchadhyaya, 10.29 to 33, those five chapters. So the Srimad Bhagavatam is considered to be like the poem of Krishna. The first two cantos are considered to be like the lotus feet of Krishna. In the Padma Puran, there is the Srimad Bhagavat Mahatmya that is described. There is a section where Lord Shiva and Parvati are talking. And Lord Shiva is telling Parvati about the glories of Srimad Bhagavatam. So there is described that 10th canto is like the face of Krishna. And in the 10th canto, these five chapters, the Ras Panchadhyaya chapters, and the 10th canto, there are 90 chapters. So chapters 29 to 33 are the beautiful smile of Krishna. So there in his book, The Dance of Divine Love, Garuda Prabhu is a beautiful example to explain the concept of Leela to a Western audience. Because Western people just can't, their brain doesn't work. They have idea of God as a very frightening, stern person. If you disobey him, he will throw thunderbolt on your thunderbolt to send you catapulting down to hell. To burn forever. And then they come to India. This is what actually happened to the Western scholars when they came to India. They came to India and they saw all these pictures of this beautiful looking boy with one hand in a butter pot, other hand, you know, trying to wipe the butter from his face. They ask, who is this? This is God! Biggest culture shock they could have imagined. And what is God doing? He's stealing butter. Stealing butter! First of all, you know, in the West, they don't have the concept of butter only. You know, they have whatever, the best that they have is cheese. So, the butter is very different. First of all, they don't understand what is butter, what is there to steal in butter? And why does God have to steal? So, they got intellectually short-circuited. Couldn't make head or tail out of it. So Garuda Prabhu gives a beautiful example. It says that Krishna performs Leela, which is like a drama. And in that drama, Yogamaya is like the director. All of you know this analogy?
Yes.
Yogamaya is like the director. And the director is invisible, but everybody acts according to the director's direction. So, who is the main hero in that Leela? It's Krishna, and his associates are there. So now, just like a millionaire may play the role of a beggar in a drama. He still remains a millionaire, but he plays the role of a beggar. Like that, Krishna is the controller of all controllers. He is the Sarveshwareshwar. You know, he is the god of all gods. Deva Deva Jagatpati, the Bhagavad Gita describes him. But he takes the role of a small innocent boy. And that boy, what does he do? He actually does such mischievous activities. So he is playing that role. But when he plays that role, it is not an illusion. That is the topmost reality. Why? Because this is something which will go on forever. When we play a role in the material world, that role ends when the drama ends. And even that, whatever role we play in our real life, that will also end when our body lifespan ends. But the role that Krishna plays in the spiritual world, it never ends. It is eternal. And that's why Krishna Leela is the most attractive. Because God does not display or brag his godhood. I am so great, bow down to me. Krishna doesn't have that sort of mood. Krishna just wants to reciprocate love with his devotees. And for the sake of reciprocating love with his devotees, he takes the role of a very small baby, different sort of roles he takes, by which he can best reciprocate love with his devotees. So Krishna is like the actor, main actor, and all the other devotees are the other actors. And sometimes the other actors may take a role superior to Krishna also. And now we may say that if Krishna is being controlled by the director, by Yogamaya, then Krishna is not God. God means he should control everyone. If God is being controlled by someone else, then he is not God. But Krishna is still God. Krishna is more cleverer than our skeptical brain. So Krishna is the script writer. The director directs according to a script. Isn't it? So who is written the script? Krishna himself has written the script. So Krishna is the script writer, Yogamaya is the director, and Krishna is the actor. So Krishna is simultaneously not in control because he is acting according to Yogamaya's direction, and he is in control because Yogamaya is directing according to his script. This is Krishna's brilliance. And in this way, Krishna performs wonderful pastimes. But actually, Krishna writes the script, and in one sense, he knows everything. Actually, if you read in Krishna Leela, when Narad Muni comes to Dwarka, at that time, Narad Muni tells very amazing things. He does two things. Jiva Goswami explains this in his Satsandarbhas, that Krishna shows to Narad Muni how he is performing different activities in different places. All of you may have read that in Krishna book. In one palace, he sees that Krishna is just going to the assembly. Other palace, he is saying that he is returning from the assembly. And the palace is saying that he is performing yajnas. And the palace is saying that he is planning for the marriage of his children. And the palace is saying that Krishna is taking food. So like that, he sees different activities going on. All are going on simultaneously. Now, Jiva Goswami makes a very subtle point over here, that he says that in the different palaces, activities were going on which were from different parts, different times of the day. That means somewhere morning activity was going on, somewhere afternoon activity, somewhere evening activity. So he uses as an example to show how Krishna is beyond time. At the same time, not only can be Krishna doing different activities, but at the same time, Krishna can be doing different activities of different times. Don't try to understand it. You know, one thing we have to understand about Krishna consciousness is that you cannot understand. And the important thing is, this is a theme which I will talk about more tomorrow. But there's a difference between knowing God and knowing about God. So we'll talk more about this tomorrow. So we don't want to know about God, we want to know God. Anyway, so Jiva Goswami says that Krishna is beyond space, he can be at different places at the same time. And he is beyond time. He can be at different times at the same time. At the same time, he is somewhere in morning, somewhere in afternoon, somewhere in evening. So there, actually, Narada Muni also describes to Krishna, Krishna, tomorrow I will see you doing this pastime. Then after that I will see you killing this demon. Then after that I will see you doing this pastime. So you know, Narada Muni also knows what Krishna is going to do. But still at the end Narada Muni says, I am very eager to see all these pastimes. So actually the joy is not just in knowing the script. Many times when we read a detective novel, purpose of detective novel is, who is the thief? Who is the thief? Who is the thief? Who is the murderer? That is the suspense. And once that suspense is revealed, then what happens is, the novel becomes very boring. If you want to read the second time, it's boring. Now, many times when we approach Krishna Leela, we also approach it that way only. If we approach it that way, then maybe a few times we will get some relish. A devotee does not approach Krishna Leela for entertainment. He approaches Krishna Leela for shelter. We want to learn how to take shelter of Krishna. This also a theme I'll be discussing in all the future classes more. What it means to take shelter of Krishna and how we take shelter of Krishna Leela. But suffice it to say that, you know, when we approach Krishna Leela, there has to be a certain attitude. And when that attitude is there, then we get the maximal benefit from it. So Krishna knows what is going to happen, but being the perfect actor. If a millionaire is doing a drama, and in that drama he's a beggar, and he's saying, कुछ खाने को दो, तीन दिन से कुछ खाया नहीं है उसी दिन में तीन बार खाया है उसने बट थिंग इज ही डज दैट एक्ट एंड इफ टू द एक्सटेंट ही गेट्स इनटू द मूड ऑफ दैट कैरेक्टर टू दैट एक्सटेंट ही विल रिलिश इट एंड टू दैट एक्सटेंट ही विल बी एबल टू मेक अदर्स रिलिश इट सुमित अली कृष्णा व्हेन ही परफॉर्म्स अ रोल अ परफॉर्म्स अ ड्रामा ही गेट्स फुल्ली इनटू दैट ड्रामा एंड He completely, in one sense, forgets that he's God. He just relishes the drama. And that is the sweetness of Krishna Leela. How God, who is the supreme being, you know, he becomes like an ordinary child, who is actually just doing some mischievous activities. So, when Krishna appeared, in this material world, he appeared in 3228 BC and he lived for 105 years. So he disappeared from the world in 3102 BC. And 3102 BC was the year when Kali Yuga started. So when Krishna appeared, we know the whole story, I won't go into the details of it all. So Krishna lived for 125 years, out of which the first 3 years he was in Gokul, the next 3 years he was in Vrindavan, the next 4 years he was in Nandagram. So first 3 years where was he? Gokul. So the Damodar Leela, killing Trunavar, killing Putana, these happened in Gokul. Then there's the pastime in the, and that is described in the Krishna book also, how Upananda. Upananda is the older brother of Nanda Maharaj. So he says how actually this is a very dangerous place. You should leave from here and go away. And they move from there to Vrindavan. And for 3 years, Krishna lives in Vrindavan. And at the age of 6, he moves from Vrindavan. And Vrindavan also he kills many demons. And from Vrindavan, he moves to Nandagram. From 6 to 10, he lives in Nandagram. And then, from 10 to the age of 38, for the next 28 years, he lives in Mathura. And there Mathura, he gets initiated. Who is his guru? Sandipani. And he goes to the Gurukul and he learns various things from the Gurukul. And then after that, then Jarasandh comes and attacks. How many times Jarasandh attacks? 70 times. And then, after the 17 attacks, Krishna disappears from there. And he takes all the citizens to Dwarvana. In fact, when they wake up, all the citizens are mystically transported. This is Krishna. Mystically transport them, and when they wake up, and they wonder, they think they are in the same palace, but they are wondering, where is the door? What is this? And there was Dwarkaha, Dwarkaha. That's how the name becomes Dwarka. Where is the door of this place? So he transports them all to Dwarka. And from there, so when Krishna is 90 years old, that is in 3138 BC, the Kurukshetra war takes place. At that time, Krishna speaks the Bhagavad Gita. And then at that time actually Gandhari curses Krishna. Because of you, my 100 sons were killed. So this is how attachment can blind a person. Actually it was Duryodhana who was adamant. And Gandhari also knows it. Somehow her attachment blinds. She curses Krishna, right? You know, that's it. I have to suffer seeing the death of all my loved ones. You will have to suffer the death of seeing the death of all your loved ones. And you will die a miserable death after 36 years. So Krishna smiles and he says, I accept your curse, O chaste one. Actually Krishna is beyond all curses, but Krishna says that as it is, I was thinking my relatives are also powerful, but they could not have been taken away from this world. So I will arrange for a mysterious way in which they will all depart from this world, and then I will depart from this world. So Maharaj Yudhishthira ruled for 36 years, and then in 3102 BC Krishna departed, and soon after that Yudhishthira Maharaj and Pandavas also departed to the north. So when Krishna appeared in this world, at that time he appeared in the prison of Vasudeva, and then he was moved to the prison of Kamsa to Vasudeva and Devaki, then he was moved to Vrindavan, or rather to Gokul more specifically. So the word Vrindavan can have two meanings. You know, within the nine forests of Vrindavan, one forest is called Vrindavan. And all the forests together also called the Vrindavan area. It's called the Vrajamandal Parikrama. It includes all the forests. So that way it can mean two things. So when Sri Krishna was moved to Vrindavan, he was moved to the Vrindavan area. And he came to Gokul. Now Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur describes that actually there is a form of Krishna who never leaves Vrindavan. That is Vrindavan Krishna. And that Krishna was born as a baby to Yashodamai. And actually when Yashodamai, by Krishna's arrangement, that night not only did Yashodamai fall unconscious during her delivery, but even those midwives, those ladies who were assisting him, they also fell asleep. And then so they came and everybody was asleep and it was dark. So he saw one child over there. He took that child and he placed Krishna in that place. So he went back. So at that time basically what happened? The Vasudev Krishna and the Vrindavan Krishna became one. And then when Vasudev had gone back, then Krishna started crying. And when Krishna started crying, that crying described was like the sound of Omkar. Sweet, melodious and powerful. And then immediately the other ladies in the house woke up and they came and they said, oh, such a beautiful child. And they were captivated by seeing the beauty of the child and the sweetness of his cry. And they called out to Yashoda, hey Yashoda, just see what a beautiful child you have got. And Yashoda woke up and she heard the cry, and she was lying on the bed, and the baby was in her swing just next to the bed. And she knew it. And when she saw that child, so captivated. At one moment it appeared that the whole child was just like a made of flowers. Now his body appeared to be like a made of shining blue flower, and his nails, blue lotuses, his nails which were Krishna's three parts, his lips, his nails, his fingernails and his two nails. Fingertips and lotus, these are like reddish. So they appear to be like reddish rose flowers. And then the remaining body of Krishna, it appeared to be like multicolored flowers. She was stunned. And then she looked again, and then she saw that this child appeared to be like jewels. And his whole body appeared to be like a blue sapphire, shining sapphire jewel. His lips and his fingers appeared to be like rubies. He appeared to be like a shining jewel. He started wondering, is this my child or is this somebody else? Who is this? And then seeing her so stunned, marveling at the beauty of Krishna, that time the elderly lady said, Upananda's wife said, she said, won't you take your child and suckle him, offer him your breast milk? Yashodamai came back to external consciousness. And then Rajeshwari Yashodamai, she picked up Krishna, and as she was about to bend up to Krishna, now her shadow fell on Krishna.
and she saw the shadow falling on Krishna, she thought that some witch has come to take away Krishna. She started screaming, "Go away, go away, go away!" And she started praying, "Narasimha, Narasimha, Narasimha!" So she was protected. She was calling out to Narasimha Dev to protect that child who is the source of Narasimha.
And seeing her anxiety, the other lady said,
"There's nobody there. Why are you worried? Just pick up the child." And she picked up the child. She picked up the child. The child was so soft. Krishna said, "The body was so soft that she felt. And actually, by the touch of my fingers, his body will get up. Even when Krishna grew up, when Nanda Maharaj would come to embrace Krishna, he would feel that my beard will put make scratches on
Krishna's skin.
So he very carefully bring Krishna and smell his head and then bless him. So Ishtamaya, at that time Krishna was just a small baby. So she picked him up, she put him on her lap, and she put him on her lap, and she offered the milk from her breast to her. And Krishna pretended as if he didn't know what to do, and he started moving his mouth. And she took her mouth and put it in the breast, and then he started drinking the milk. And then as he was drinking the milk, he became very happy. And as he was drinking the milk, some of the milk spilled out from the mouth onto the body, and then Mother Yashoda was wiping it with her hands and with the sari cloth, and she was beholding the beauty of her child. And as she looked carefully, she saw that there was a white marking on his chest, and she thought that it is actually some milk that has dropped off, fallen off from the chest, from the mouth onto the chest, and she tried to wipe it off, and to her amazement it didn't wipe off. She realized with wonder, what is this? And she looked carefully and she saw actually to the tuft of white hair that was there. And that is the mark of Srivatsa. It is the mark of Srivatsa that is there on all forms of the Supreme Lord. Baksho, Viharini, Lakshmi Devi's desire is evident. Vaksha in the chest. Viharini, Palluru. And she was amazed. Maybe this is a sign of some Mahapurusha. And then she turned around. And she looked at the other side and she saw one golden line over there. And she tried to move it and it wouldn't move. So, Lakshmi Devi came as the Srivatsa hair on the right side. But she was thinking that, oh, I am deprived of the left side of the Lord. She appeared there as a golden line. So, she is present on both sides of the chest of the Lord. And she was just marveling the beauty of the child, looking at his tenderness. And she felt waves of joy overflooding in her heart. And those waves of love that were in her heart, they came out from the heart as our liquefied love in the form of milk. And Krishna drank that love and satisfied her heart. At that time, the other lady said, "Let us go and inform Nanda Maharaj." Nanda Maharaj had been performing austerities for a long time to have a child. And despite performing austerities for a long time, he had not been able to have a child. So finally he went to the great rishis. And the rishis told him that we will give you a special mantra. You chant this mantra will fulfill your desire. And then they gave him the Hare Krishna. And then Ananda Maharaj chanted the holy names. They performed worship of Lord Narayan very intensely. And then finally, now his desire was going to be fulfilled. So, Nanda Maharaj was out in the fields at that time. So they asked a Brahmani, an elderly Brahmani who was wearing white sari and her hair was white because of it. And he told, "Please go and inform Nanda Maharaj." So that old lady started running. And when she came to Nanda Maharaj, she offered her respects and told her, "Great joy has descended into your life. Your innermost desire has been fulfilled. You have got a son." And then the Maharaj heard this. His heart jumped with joy. Now his heart had been like a small pond which had been dried up because of the heat of not having a child. And now when he heard that he had got a child, it appeared like the pond had suddenly been filled, not with a huge torrential shower, not of water, but of nectar. He felt as if he was swimming and bathing and drinking and feasting in the heavenly nectar. It is there in the Nandan Gardens. He felt as if he was swimming in the celestial Ganges. His joy knew no bounds. And he ran to the palace where the baby was. And when he came inside the palace, and he looked at the baby, and when he saw the beauty, he became petrified as if turned to stone. He looked like a painting, like a person in a painting, or an image sculpted in stone. There was, as he was beholding the beautiful form of Krishna, there was no motion in any part of the body. The only emotion was the tears that were moving down his eyes, the tears of joy. And then the lady of the palace said, "Won't you embrace your child?" And the Maharaj came back to external consciousness. And like a person waking up, and he immediately went and Yashodamai offered a child to him. He picked up and embraced the child. And as soon as he touched the child, he felt as if the currents of joy were permeating through his body. And he looked at the child. First he was wonderstruck by the beauty of the child. Then he was wonderstruck by how much joy the child radiated. What I did was this. Was this his own son? Had the son had brought happiness, or had happiness incarnated as his son? He was amazed. And then he started embracing and fondling the child. And then Nanda Maharaj started giving charity. This guy, when Nanda Maharaj started giving charity, she gave such profuse charity that he put the desire trees, the Surbhi cows, and the Chintamani stones to shame. The desire tree is actually can yield whatever we desire. But they yield it, or the Surbhi cow can give whatever we desire. But they give it when we ask for it. But Nanda Maharaj was giving charity even without asking. Anybody would give whatever charity they wanted and didn't want, he was just profusely giving charity. He was giving cows, he was giving silk, he was giving jewels, he was giving gold. The joy of his heart was unlimited. And by Krishna's mercy, his treasury was unlimited. And the charity that he gave was also unlimited. And then, under the loving protection of his parents, Krishna started growing. And as he was growing, Krishna had the name-giving ceremony. So, Karga Muni came, and he very trickily told, "You know, your son is just like Narayan. So, just like Narayan." So, because he had told like this, so whenever Krishna would kill any demons, so what Nanda Maharaj would think? That at that time, when Krishna has to fight with, Krishna is just like, he's just my child, but whenever he has to fight with demons, the power of Narayan enters into him and kills the demon. And then afterwards, the power leaves him. So then he becomes, he's my child. He said, "I have to protect him." So Gargacharya told him, he didn't want to tell him that he's Narayan. Because if you told him he's Narayan, then he will not be able to reciprocate love with him. So he told him, "He's just like Narayan." And then as Krishna started growing up, then his name giving ceremony was there. Now Krishna and Balaram were always together. So because Krishna and Balaram were together, so whenever the parents, Rohini or Yashoda or Nanda Maharaj, they would call Krishna, Ram. So at that time, both of them would turn their heads. They couldn't make out which is whose name. And seeing this, both of them, Yashoda and Rohini, would start laughing. And then decide we should separate these two babies. Otherwise they will never learn. And they would, when they would keep the babies at separate distance, they say, "Krishna." And both of them would turn. They say, "Oh, he's gone towards her. Oh, that means he is Krishna." And Ram, when Krishna would turn his head, "Oh, he's gone there. That means that is Ram." And then they started recognizing their names. And then they started speaking the first words. The first word that they spoke was Mama, then Dada, started speaking. And then they learned each other's names. So Krishna would call Rama, call, Balaram would call Krishna. And interestingly, Krishna would not call Balaram as Rama, he would call him as Dauji. Dauji. So, because he's the older brother. The older brother should be addressed with respect. So, actually even later on in Bhagavatam, if you read all the Krishna book,
Krishna very rarely refers to Balaram as Balaram. Only in official assembly, when some decision is to be taken, then Lord Balaram will go there for this purpose. But otherwise, in their personal address, we always call him as Rauji. Actually, so that is Krishna, even his babyhood, is teaching us what is culture. Culture means essentially respect. The essence of culture is not the dress that we wear. The essence of culture is not the hairstyle or the lip style or the death style we have. The essence of culture is how we are respecting everyone. So, actually, if there is no respect, that means there is no culture. So, now in the modern times, I saw one family where, you know, the boy who had come to meet me, so I'll just get Sandy here. The way I was talking about Sandy, I thought he's a family dog or something. I said, who is Sandy? Oh, that is my grandfather. What?
So, you know, calling your grandfather, first of all, by his name itself is not good, and to call by a nickname. It's too much. So there's no respect, you know. Sometimes you call the parents by the first name, the wives call their husband by the first name.
It's very, they think that it's actually intimacy. But, you know, intimacy can develop, intimacy means very close, affectionate relationship. Intimacy can develop only after respect, never before respect. Intimacy is the result of respect, it can never be the source of respect. So first, we have to develop a respectful relationship with others. Whenever we meet other devotees, we always call them Prabhu. Sometimes somebody would say, oh, I am so intimate with him, I don't have to call him Prabhu, he understands. And I also understand. But actually that is a premise. First, we have to learn to develop respect for others. And the external, first of all, at least we should show external respect. Whether internally we have respect or not, that is not so easy to cultivate. At least externally we show respect by calling people as Prabhu. And then after that, gradually the internal respect will come. And in the very advanced stage, we may call people intimately. But I have seen even sannyasis when they write to each other. For example, once I was in the Arhanath Maharaj's office, at that time, Giriraj Maharaj's phone had come. So, in the phone of Pigra, so he was asking, can I please speak to His Holiness Radhanath Swami Maharaj? So he is God-brother, but he's also calling, addressing so respectfully. And I've seen most of the sannyasis also, like I get to edit their books. So like Jayadutt Maharaj or Radhanath Maharaj, they write names. They write, I am like their son or their disciple or their nephew. They write, my dear Chaitanya Charan Prabhu. Why? They don't have to say that. At all do they. So if a guru can call his disciple as Prabhu, at least we can call our God-brother and our equal as Prabhu. We should not think that we are so advanced that we don't need to call Prabhu. So, when we have respect for others, then gradually that respect will mature into intimacy. But the Western idea is that because I am intimate, I don't have to show any respect. But then that relationship doesn't last for very long. In the companies, nowadays in software companies, they don't call the boss as sir. They say, let's call the boss by the first name. Seems very intimate, but the boss will let you call him by the first name, but you know, he will squeeze your blood to the last drop. If you don't do work, then first name, last name, nothing matters. You will be fired immediately. In India, the boss, early in Indian culture, you respect the boss, and the boss, even if you are not able to do the work, you fall sick or something like that, the company or the employer is there to take care. So relationships actually are nourished by respect. It's not easy to offer respect. It said that, you know, nourishing a relationship is like watering a tree. Now, initially you have to spend a lot of time for watering a tree and there's no result. But when the tree grows, the tree gives a shelter and fruits. So like that, initially you have to spend a lot of time being respectful, being very careful, being very loving, and gradually there is the fruit. We get shelter, we get fruit. We get shelter when we are in trouble. We get the fruit of love, warmth, care, understanding. All these result when initially there is respect. So then as Krishna and Balaram started growing, they started playing. So first they learned to turn around. Now every event in Krishna's life was a festival. When he was lying on his back and he turned around, then there was a festival. When he started walking, there was a festival. So Mother Yashoda would tell him to walk. And she first would make him walk and make him hold his hand. And then as he was walking, and he was very frightened, I'll fall down. Then as he was walking, suddenly Mother Yashoda will pull off her hand. And Krishna will become frightened. that Lord who is the shelter of the whole world.
He is saying, as if I don't have the shelter, he looks very frightened.
Mother Isha will run ahead. He said, come here, come here. And then Krishna would pretend as if he cannot walk. And somehow he would walk and run to his mother and catch her mother's legs. And Mother Isha would feel so happy. And then Mother Isha, as he learned to walk, then she put ankle bells on her legs, on his legs. Of course, there are bangles all the time. And the ornaments were there all the time. So ankle bells were there. And then Krishna would walk, chin, chin, the ankle bell would ring. And Krishna would wonder, where is the sound coming from? Is somebody hiding? And again he would chin, chin. Again he would wonder, where is the sound coming from? And the small child had become frightened. Is somebody hiding here? Is somebody going to attack me? And his face, which was initially going puzzled, went, changed to fear. And again he would walk, chin, chin. And then and Rohini and Yashoda, and they would see this, they would start laughing. And then Krishna would see them laughing and he would look at them with his eyes wide with fear. And as he would turn and walk, chan chan, and then he would become more frightened and he would start running. And with running, the ankle bells would sound more chan chan chan, and Krishna would become more frightened. He would run and hide himself in mother's sari. And both of them would start laughing. And then I started growing. And the Upananda, Nanda Maharaj had five brothers. Upananda, Abhinanda, Nanda, Sunanda, and Nandana. So Nanda Maharaj was like the middle of them. So actually Nanda Maharaj was, although the middle one, he was the most illustrious among all of them. So Jiva Goswami in his Gopal Champu says that perhaps we can compare Nanda with Arjuna. Because among the five Pandavas, the most illustrious, the most talented, the most expert in weaponry was Arjuna. But he says no, there's not adequate comparison. Because all the five Pandavas were the objects of affection for Mother Kunti. But he says Nanda had such beautiful qualities that Nanda was the sole object of affection for his parents and for everyone. Not that others were neglected, but the love for him was so overwhelming. So their father was Parjanya. Their Parjanya's father was Devamidha. So Devamidha had two wives. One wife was the Kshatriya, one wife was the Vaishya. So the Kshatriya wife, the son that was born was Surasen. And Surasen's son was Vasudeva. And from Devamidha's other wife, Vaishya wife, the son that was born was Parjanya. And Parjanya's one of the sons was Nanda. So Nanda and Vasudeva were related like that through their grandfather. They were distant cousins. So so when he was to be coronated, when Devamidha eventually handed over one part of his kingdom to Surasen, another part of the kingdom to Parjanya. And Parjanya, when he became old, he decided to retire and focus on devotional service entirely. So then he wanted to hand over the throne. So he handed over the throne to his oldest son, Upananda. And it was a big ceremony. So Vasudev and all the elders from their family, from the Mathura, they were all there. And he came and put the crown on Upananda's head. And Upananda accepted the crown. And then he got up from the throne. And he went and placed the crown on Nanda's head. And Nanda trembled in fear. He folded his hands. And then Upananda turned to the assembly and he said, extremely profound words of wisdom. He said, leadership is based on affection. Affection, this is how can somebody become a leader, is not just a post. It's not that you get a post and oh, you are made into a leader, so therefore you are the leader. So that sort of leader will not last for very long. So leadership is based on affection. So only when the followers feel affection for the leader can the leader go on. It's like we see Srila Prabhupada. You know, he was an old person. And generally if you see in most families, the old person just kept neglected somewhere. People don't even want to come in. They don't want to see him. And they, especially they don't want others to see him when guests come to the house. Hey, let him be in a corner. So Prabhupada, so many young people were ready to lay down their life for him. Why? Because there was affection. So he says leadership arises from affection. Affection arises when there is sweet behavior. Why did people feel affectionate for Srila Prabhupada? Because Prabhupada was so sweet in behavior.
because he loves so much everyone. So affection comes when there is
sweet behavior.
And sweet behavior is possible when there are good qualities. Therefore, ultimately leadership based on qualities. Leadership is based on affection, affection is based on behavior, behavior is based on qualities. So then he said, the qualities of Drandha are such that he doesn't deserve to rule under me, but rather he deserves to rule the whole world. Therefore, let him rule our kingdom on my behalf. I hand the kingdom over to him. So as a service to his older brother, on his instruction, Nanda Maharaj accepted the throne. Nanda Maharaj, actually the very word Nanda, Nanda, da means to give. Nanda means Ananda. One who gives happiness to others is a Nanda. So the word Nanda means Nanda. One who gives happiness to others. And the word Yashoda means Yashada. Yasha means fame. One who gives fame to others. So actually, Krishna had such illustrious parents that Nanda would give happiness to others and Yashoda would give fame to others. But when Krishna came in their lives, Krishna gave Ananda to Nanda and Krishna gave Yasha to Yashoda. That is Krishna's inconceivable ability. So in this way, Krishna performed very beautiful pastimes as Nanda Maharaj father. So Nanda Maharaj, although he was the third son, he became the king. But whenever Upananda would give any suggestion, Nanda Maharaj would take it as an instruction and follow it. And in this, Jiva Goswami compares the relationship between Nanda and Upananda to the relationship between Chitrangada and Bhishma Pitama. So Bhishma Pitama was older, but Bhishma Pitama had taken a vow that I will not become the king. Chitrangada and Vichitravirya were the younger brothers. They became the king, but they would always follow the instruction of Bhishma. Of course, the generation after that, Dhritarashtra and Duryodhana never followed Bhishma.
Unfortunately.
But, so he said, in this way, Nanda would always follow the instruction. So therefore Upananda suggested, let us leave and go to Vrindavan. Immediately Nanda Maharaj again. So Upananda's wife was like the grand old lady of the house. So one day she came to Krishna and said, Krishna, show me your teeth. Krishna became very shamefaced. My teeth have not yet come.
My teeth have not yet come. And hearing this, she cash got him and embraced him and started laughing.
And as Krishna started growing, and he started playing around, and we know how he would go around stealing butter. So initially, as he grew up, he learned to walk, and then he started at that time. So the first demoness who came was Putana, when he was still a breast-sucking baby. Then the next demon was Trunava, Shaktasura. Then was Trunava. So these three were there. And then after that, even when Krishna was still drinking his mother's milk, actually, even when Krishna grows up, this is the mystery of Krishna Leela, that in the spiritual world, Krishna's eternal age,
because Krishna has an age.
Is there time in the spiritual world? Mm-hmm. Yes, there is time in the spiritual world. But that time does not control or destroy. That time just creates variety for Krishna's pastime. In this material world, when there is time, that time controls. Just like when we go for yatra to Mayapur, we feel, oh, it's so wonderful. But then the yatra ends and we have to come back. So because time controls. If you are late for a train, the train goes away. So time controls over you. And time destroys. Time makes people into old. But in Krishna Leela, time doesn't control and time doesn't destroy. When Krishna wanted to perform Ras Leela, at that time he expanded time so that one night was like one Brahma's night. And the gopis performed wonderful pastimes with Krishna during that time. So Krishna can expand that. And similarly, when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would perform Sankirtan at night, the devotees would be so ecstatic. And while the sun would come, the sun would start rising, the devotees would get so angry at the sun. Why are you rising? It is described in Chaitanya Bhagavata that their anger seemed to be so great, it appeared as by their anger they would burn the sun only. So, time doesn't control the spiritual world. And time doesn't destroy. So, in the spiritual world, everyone is eternally of the same age that they are. So Yashodama and Nanda Maharaj are elderly. They are not old, they are just elderly. Middle age sort of, 40 something.
And then the only old person in Vrindavan is Purnamasi. The Purnamasi is one older lady, she is like the grandmother of the whole village of Vrindavan. And she is the advisor. So she advises what should be done, how it should be done. So Krishna's eternal age in the spiritual world is 15 years. He is Kishore. Now Krishna's pastimes from his age of 1 to 5 are called as Kumarila. Then 5 to 10 are called as the Paugandila. And 10 to 15 are called as the Kaishorila. So although Krishna lived only for 10 years in Vrindavan, actually his age from 1 to 3 was like 5 years. Hearing the time is such a way. Although Krishna lived for 10 years in Vrindavan, from the age of 1 to 3 when he lived, that was equivalent to 5 years. So 1 to 3, I mentioned earlier, so where they lived in Gokul. That was his Kumarlila. Then 3 to 6, when he was in Vrindavan, that was his Paugandalila. And 6 to 10, when they moved to Mandiram, that was his time of his Kaishorlila. So each of these forms is conducive for a particular rasa. The Kumar Lila is most conducive for Vatsalya. So, Mother Yashoda and Nanda Maharaj, even when Krishna grows up to be 15 years, they still see Krishna like a small 3-4 year old child. And Miyogamaya arranges everything in such a way. Because Krishna's Kishora Roop is the original form, eternal form. But that Kishora Roop contains all the other forms. And when Krishna is reciprocating love with any particular devotee, accordingly that form manifests. So Yashoda Maya and Nanda Maharaj always see Krishna like a small baby. It is very beautifully described in Anand Vrindavan Champu by Kavi Karuna Pu. So then, the Kumara Roop is best for Vatsalyas. The Pauganda Roop is from 5 to 10. That is the best for the Sakya Ras. That is, so the Pauganda Roop is called the Sakya Rasa Vigraha. That is a vigraha, which is vigraha, that is form, is that is the shelter for Sakya Ras. And for Madhurya Ras, it is Kaishora Roop from 10 to 15. So Krishna performed very beautiful, sweet pastimes in each of these ages. And those particular devotees eternally see him like that. They eternally see him, even when he becomes middle-aged, then the Maya Yashoda see him just like a small boy who needs our protection. As Krishna was performing these pastimes, he would conquer the hearts of every one of them. So I have not even started the Yagya Brahman pastime. Maybe we'll discuss that tomorrow. But I'll tell one brief pastime, which will end, and then we'll have some question answers if you have any. So when Krishna, as a Kumara Roop, he started, and the first activity he started doing was stealing butter. So he would go from house to house, and he would steal butter, and he would come back. So the gopis, they noticed that the butter in their house is missing. So initially, Krishna would steal butter in his own house. And one time he was stealing butter, and a small baby was going in a pot and stealing, and he stole and ate. He was looking around furtively like a thief. Somebody there, and suddenly he saw somebody watching him. Well, yeah, and he looked very carefully. Actually, Nanda Bhavan had such shining, transparent walls, not transparent, reflecting walls, that he saw his own form over there. And Krishna wondered, Krishna thought this is somebody else who's come. Kya kar rahe ho? That person was like, what are you doing? Shhh. That person was like, shhh. Krishna was wondering, what is happening? Krishna went up and he took up to that and he took some butter in his hands. मैया को बोलना मत, तुमको भी थोड़ा माखन दूंगा मैं. कृष्णा स्टार्टेड टेकिंग द बकर एंड पुटिंग इट ऑन द वॉल एंड ही वंडरिंग व्हाट इज नॉट गोइंग टू हिज माउथ एंड एक्चुअली यशोदा माई वाज वाचिंग एवरीथिंग फ्रॉम आउट देयर एंड शी सॉ कृष्णा बिविल्डर्ड फेस शी वाज वाचिंग ऑल दिस शी वाज स्माइलिंग बट शी सॉ कृष्णा बिविल्डर्ड फेस शी कुड नॉट रेजिस्ट एंड स्टार्टेड लाफिंग एंड देन then Krishna realized, oh, I'm caught! And then immediately first he tried to put his hand behind his back. And then he realized, oh, there is butter on it. Then he started looking. And then he realized, I'm caught. And then immediately he looked around. He said, Main nahi chura raha, wo chura raha. I'm not stealing, he's roaming. I was trying to stop.
stop him. I was telling him that you will punish him. Catch him and punish him.
Then I caught an embraced him and started caressing him.
So then Krishna started going out. And when he started going out, he started stealing in other devotees' houses, other elderly gopis' houses. So when you start stealing there, he will
go through the windows alone.
Very planned, organized thief. You watch him, you tell him, Shidam, I watch in this direction. Padmangal, you watch in this direction. And then they will watch, and then nobody is there, they will all go in, climb in through the window, go through the door, and search and steal the butter and eat the butter. And eat the butter, and when they would finish eating, then they would start giving charity to the monkeys. They would give to the monkeys. And then the gopis would come, and they would say, Krishna, what are you doing? And they start running. Hey, why are you stealing our butter? Since you are butter, who will steal? Even these monkeys don't want to eat your
butter. And then he would go. And then
the gopis would try to catch him. And they couldn't catch him. And then eventually, one day the gopis decided to make a plan. They will catch him. So, all of you know that bell pastime? So Krishna decided that what he will do is, the gopis decided that on the butter pots we'll tie bells. So when Krishna puts his hand inside the butter pot, ding 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 ding, all the bells will ring. And then it was all dark. And then Krishna came. Krishna came, just touched, and he saw there's something here. Oh, these gopis are planning to catch me. They think they are clever, they don't know who I am. So he clapped his hands softly. And he called the demigod in control of bells.
And he told him, don't ring.
Whatever you order, I'm asking, shh, softly.
And then Krishna started climbing out of the pot. And then he put the hand in the pot and said,
ding 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 What happened? He said, actually, the scriptures instruct me that whenever bhoga is offered to the Lord, I should always
refuse.
I am not the Lord in Vrindavan. Get out of here.
Never be here after.
Another time, Krishna decided that the rest of the gopis couldn't catch it, they ran away. But the gopis decided that this time we will all hide in the same room. That time they had thought that we will keep the bells and we will do our work. And when Krishna comes, the bell will ring, and then we will come and catch. But they would run away. Thought we will hide there itself. So then, they were hiding in the same room and Krishna came. Now Krishna has one friend. Most of the Krishna's friends are Vaishyas. One friend is a Brahmana. He is Madhumangala. Madhumangala has another name called Kusumasava. Kusum is flower. Asava is the essence, the nectar which comes out of it. So Kusumasava speaks very sweet nectarian words. Other name is Batu Dvijaraj. You know in that song, Jai Radhe Jai Krishna. Batu is small. Dvijaraj is the best among the Brahmanas. So he's a little fatty and he has a little lame leg, so he can't run very fast. But he's a Brahman, very proud of being a Brahman also. So he'll also come with all the gopas to steal Batu. So one day, Madhumangala has one characteristic, he likes to eat a lot. He has a big belly. So he's big belly. So what happened? All the gopas came to steal the butter. And when they came to steal the butter, they had all surrounded the pot and they were about to eat. Putting the hand in the pot. And the gopis said, "We caught you now!" And Bago, Krishna, and all the gopas started running. They ran to the window and the gopis were catching him. Now Krishna is male and all the gopas are male. And the gopis are female, so Krishna is stronger. So So he just jumped up the window and went up, and then from outside, you know, he was pulling his Gopa up and pulling him. So Krishna was pulling from above, the gopis are pulling from below. And Krishna pulled them out. And then everybody came out. The Madhubangal was the last person to be slow to run to the window. And when he came out, the gopis are pulling from below and Krishna was pulling from above. But because he had such a heavy stomach, you know, Krishna got exhausted. And the gopis were pulling from below. Boom! Madhubangal came down. Re Bap Re! Then, chore, abhi tumko pitega main. And they all started beating him from top, bottom, lovingly. And Madhubangal was frightened and being beaten, and he was wondering what to do. Krishna has also run away now. Who will save me? And suddenly he got an idea. Ruko! Wait. Don't you know who I am? I'm a Brahmana.
And he pointed out his threat.
And he said, if you offend me, I will curse you. You know the power of a Brahmana,
sir. He became a little frightened. Some of them were young gopis also. Some of them were little middle-aged gopis.
So he became frightened.
What will he curse? Will he send us to hell? He said,
I will curse you that you will get married to a 70-year-old man who already has 7 wives.
And they became very frightened. And he said, please don't curse us like this. Please don't curse us like this.
So he says,
please forgive us for offending you. He says, words alone are not enough. If you want me to forgive you, then you must offer me prasad. What do you like?
They said, laddu, get laddus.
And then all the gopis went to their homes and they got laddus.
And then he ate Atman's laddus, his stomach became bigger. And then he carried laddus and he came back to Krishna. Krishna said, you want to steal butter, you couldn't get butter, but I got laddus and came back.
And then
Krishna said, oh, you are very clever. Very clever, he said. But
don't come with us again, because next time you may not get laddus.
So then all these gopis decide that we will come and complain to Krishna. Complain to Yashodamai. So when they came to Yashodamai, at that time, what Krishna did? Krishna was very intelligent. So Krishna went and he stole butter, and when he came back, he came from a backside. And he pretended to be sleeping. And then Yashodamai said, hello, your son, Yashodamai, the gopis came with him, your son, he is so naughty, he creates trouble for all of us. What happened? Actually, he is constantly coming and pestering us. He spoils our house cleanliness, he steals butter, he spills butter, he wastes so much of the treasure of our house. You should discipline him, you should punish him. Krishna is stealing butter? Krishna has not woken up till now. He is still sleeping. Krishna is very intelligent. So what he did was, when his mother Yashoda came, he was sleeping. Then he went and he stole butter and came back, and again Yashoda came and saw, he is still sleeping only. He is still sleeping. And at that time, Krishna woke. And Krishna pretended as if he is rubbing his eyes. Maya, maya, bhook lagi hai. I am hungry. And Yashoda and other gopis says, don't believe him. Natak mein ustad hai wo. He is expert at doing false dramas. He said, what happened? Krishna came to Yashoda mai. Bhook lagi hai. Kuskana, they are telling that you are stealing butter at their house. Butter at their house? Yeah. Yeah, you make such good quality butter. Their butter is so low quality. Who steal butter at their house? Even if they give butter in charity, I will not take it. So, the elderly gopis were flustered. Yashoda said, now you have already spoken enough bad names to Krishna and you have chastised him enough. Now leave him alone. And the gopis said, okay, next time you will catch him and bring him red-handed to you. You are not ready to believe us. And Yashoda took and embraced him. She told Krishna, when you steal, butter at our home, it is all right.
Especially small baby, no?
But if you steal butter outside, then who will give their daughter in marriage to you? So Krishna, at that point, why are you blaming me for nothing? And at that time Nanda Maharaj came back home. And then Nanda Maharaj, Krishna just jumped off. And he ran to Nanda Baba, what happened? Why am I being chastised for nothing? What happened? And Yashodamai told the whole story. And both Nanda Maharaj and Yashodamai love Krishna very much. But when Yashodamai gets angry, then Nanda Maharaj always takes the side. Whenever there is a difference, when Yashodamai is chastising Krishna, Nanda Maharaj always takes the side of Krishna. Nanda Maharaj became very grave. And he said that that person who has chastised Krishna deserves to be chastised. And Nanda Maharaj, Krishna was in Nanda Maharaj's lap.
He pointed to Yashodamai.
And then Nanda Maharaj turned to Krishna. And he said, oh Krishna, now you need not go to Yashodamai. You can just stay in my lap. And as soon as Krishna heard this, Krishna jumped off Nanda Maharaj's lap and went to Yashodamai's lap. And seeing this unpredictable, childish, sweet behavior of the children, both of them started laughing. And then next time the gopis had planned properly. This time we will catch Krishna only. So next time Krishna went to steal butter, at that time the gopi was in the same room and Krishna went in to steal water, and then gopi had decided that he will not try to catch all the gopas because the leader of all of them is Krishna. You know, even if we catch the other gopas, it's not of much use. If we catch Krishna and Krishna is chastised and disciplined, then that will solve the whole problem at the moment. So when all the gopas saw that this gopi is coming, just ran straight to Krishna. All of them tried to run away, but she ran straight to Krishna and she caught Krishna by the hand. And pakad liya, I caught you now. Now I will take you to your mother. He started parading him through his street. Krishna said, meri beizzati mat karo aise. Don't disgrace me like this. If you want to take me, at least cover my face. Uh-huh. That everybody will not see me. And then she said, okay, let's cover your face. So, you know, she had her own sari cloth was there, so she put it on his face. And then Krishna was going along, and now in those days, the gopal and gopi would get married at a very young age. They would not stay together, but they were just officially married. So, Krishna was going along, and as he was going along, at that time, Krishna told the gopi, you are holding my hand so tightly that my hand is paining. You know, my hand is so tender. And you grind the mortar, your hand is so tough, my hand will break. He says, at least, you hold my other hand. So Krishna spoke so sweetly, the gopi could not resist. And Krishna said, okay. And what Krishna had done was, this gopi was married and he had an older sister who was married to one of the gopas who was a friend of Krishna. So that gopa was right there. Krishna blinked at him. And when she released the hand, Krishna ran away and that gopa came over. And because the cloth was on the face, she couldn't see that. And she touched the hand and started going along. And Krishna ran by the back door and again he went to his room. And he lay down in bed, peacefully sleeping. And then the gopi came, Yashoda, dekho, tumhare kana ko pakad liya maine. I have caught your kana now. Achha, kaha hai? And kana to so raha hai ghar mein. And then Krishna came, maiya bhook lagi hai. And then she became really bewildered. I just caught you. And she picked up the cloth. And she saw Devarji. She saw his only brother-in-law. And she was so bewildered. Yashodamai said, I told you are just making false accusations against my Krishna. Now just see, you have got your own brother-in-law in the name of my Krishna. If he is stealing, then punish him. Why are you complaining and accusing about my Krishna? Gopi was completely bewildered. I saw Krishna, I captured Krishna, now how has he come over?
And then completely bewildered, she lost her interest, she was going away. And Krishna,
from the wall of his house, he climbed on the wall of his house. Suno! Here. Next time you try to catch me, I will become your husband.
And he made a big face at her and went away. And
Gopi
went back completely bewildered.
And then in this way, Krishna performed so many sweet pastimes. We know that one time Krishna, Mother Yashoda told him, again and again the complaints are coming. Okay, he said, I will actually remove all the, I said, why don't you keep all the ornament, all the, but in a dark place, Krishna will not be able to see. He says, no, Krishna has ornaments, and his ornaments are shining so much that he will see anywhere. He says, okay, then I'll remove the ornaments. Oh, I'll remove the ornaments. But you know, actually his body itself has effulgence. So wherever he goes, it becomes warm. It becomes bright. Okay, then Vishwamitra said, I will tie up Krishna and I will not let him go out of the house only. And the gopis thought about it. But then they went and told him, no, if you tie up Krishna, then what is the use of making our butter? What is the use of making butter? So another time one gopi came to Krishna and she said, Krishna, come, I will give you some butter. Krishna turned to her. मैं क्या भिखारी हूँ क्या? Am I a beggar? Then I will come and take charity from you now. And he just embraced Krishna. And then she gave him something to eat. Another time Krishna was playing in the mud, you know, making some castles, making some houses. That Lord who makes all the universes, he was struggling to make castles. One gopi came, Krishna, come to my house, I'll give you some sweets. Krishna said, can't you see? I am busy. I don't have any spare time. And the gopi just smiled and she caught Krishna and she took him and she gave nice sweet foodstuffs. So the gopis, for them the whole purpose of making butter was to actually attract Krishna to come and steal the butter, and their complaining was also a part of the leela. So Krishna, in a small child, if you see, there are mothers, they always want to talk about the child. My child did this, my child did that. You know, the child is very simple, gentle, nice, but then the mothers won't have anything to talk about. So Krishna would act as a very mischievous and sweet child just so that he would give Mother Yashoda and all the devotees so much katha to talk about. As Bilva Mangal Thakur in his Chauradharan and Ashtagam prays, Navaneeta Chauram Praje Prasidham Navaneeta Chauram गोपांगणानां च दुकुलचौरं अनेक जन्मार्जित पापचौरं चौराग्रगण्यं पुरुषं नमामि. This is Braje Prasidha. In that Vrindavan is Prasiddha, is famous as Navaneeta Chauram. He sings brother. So my dear Lord, that Lord, please, what do you do? Anek janmarjit papachauram. My dear Lord, you please come and steal. My heart is covered by all these sins. You come and please steal away all those sins. And actually, Lord will come in our heart and he will steal our heart also. First he comes as the holy name. In the initial stages, the holy name steals away all our sins. Steals away all our sins. And by that, our hearts become softened. Our hearts are hard like stone right now. And by the repeated chanting of the holy name, by the repeated remembrance of Krishna, our heart becomes soft. And when our hearts become soft, then they become soft like butter, then butter thief Krishna will come and steal our hearts. And when steal our hearts, then that is the ultimate gain. Now our hearts are stolen by the advertising agencies, by this mobile and this car and this girl and this bike. And they are all very unworthy thieves. Thief that we want Krishna, to steal our heart is Krishna. And Krishna steals our heart, that is our greatest gain. For he will come and reside in our heart and that will make us supremely happy. So when we hear these wonderful pastimes, it's not just for hearing and relishing. Actually we should pray that our hearts become attracted to Krishna. And when the heart become attracted to Krishna, then there is real happiness. Then the karshan ends and the akarshan brings ananda in our life. So I'll summarize.
and we'll continue with the past tense tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So we started by discussing about how Krishna comes in this world for three external reasons. You know, he comes to destroy and deliver the demons, to protect the devotees, to establish dharma. But the real reason is that he comes to take us back from this miserable material world to the spiritual world. We discussed how this world is always a place of misery. Now, I was talking about how Stephen Hawking wants to go from this world to another planet. But that planet is also temporary. And that planet also, if we humans go, we will create problems there also. So, the temporary nature we cannot change. There will be no peace ever in this world. But if we change our consciousness, we can become peaceful. We discussed like a pond, our heart being like a small puddle or being like a ocean. So if we seek external pleasures, we have very little inner happiness. Then our heart becomes empty. Very little inner happiness. But if we connect with Krishna in our heart, then our heart becomes like an ocean. Then external situations don't trouble us. Because we have inner wealth, inner happiness. Then we discussed about how everybody lives their life based on faith and hope. So people put faith in false things. We discussed about the worldwide stupidity. WWS. What was that?
Work, watch, shop.
So we discussed how people are working more and more hard from the agriculture, industrial, the information age. And then how people are being exploited more and more, to shop more and more. Sure, the modern economy is the economy of unnecessities. And it's unsustainable. And people are being exploited. So we put our promises here in a discussion about how Western culture is so terrible. Small children are falling prey to sexual deviations and things like that. So people have the problem with the world is that the foolish are confident and the wise are doubtful. So because we are unable to put faith in Krishna, we put faith in advertising agencies instead. So Krishna comes and reveals his own sweet pastimes so that our heart will become attracted. So that we see that these pastimes are real, they happen here in this world and they are eternally happening in the spiritual world. And then we started discussing about Krishna's pastimes, the childhood pastimes. How when he came, he flooded the heart of Nanda Maharaj with love and he went whole of Vrindavan with love. And then we discussed especially the childhood pastimes of stealing butter. Krishna performed. And we pray that Krishna comes and steal our heart also. So, we will conclude with one prayer. I think most of you know this prayer. Nunspirat Vasudeva Sudeva Sutam Devam Kamsa Chanura Mardhanam Devaki Paramanandam Krishnam Vande Jagat Guru. So you can recite this prayer. It's very simple. Vasudeva Sutam Devam. So Vasudeva's son is the Supreme Lord. So Krishna's name is not Vasudeva, it is Vasudeva. Vasudeva Sutam Devam. What does it do? Kamsa Chanura Mardhanam. He defeated Kamsa and Chanu, the wrestler who was engaged with him. And he brought the supreme happiness in Vasudevaki. Devaki Paramanandam. That Krishna, who is the spiritual master of the whole world, Krishnam Vande Jagat Guru. I offer my respectful obeisances to him. Vasudeva Sutam Devam.
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 Kamsa Chanura Mardhanam.
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 Vasudeva Sutam Devam Kamsa Chanura Mardhanam.
Vasudeva Sutam Devam Kamsa Chanura Mardhanam.
Devaki Paramanandam.
Devaki Paramanandam.
Krishnam Vande Jagat Guru.
Krishnam Vande Jagat Guru.
Devaki Paramanandam. Krishnam Vande Jagat Guru.
Devaki Paramanandam. Krishnam Vande Jagat Guru.
Devaki ki paramanandam krishnam vande jagadguru
devaki paramanandam krishnam vande jagadguru
devaki paramanandam krishnam vande jagadguru
devaki paramanandam krishnam vande jagadguru
vasudevasutam devam kamsa chanu mardanam
vasudevasutam devam kamsa chanu mardanam
devaki paramanandam krishnam vande jagadguru
devaki paramanandam krishnam vande jagadguru
so I recite the full once and you can recite the rest of it. Vasudevasutam devam kamsa chanuramardanam devaki paramanandam krishnam vande jagadguru
vasudevasutam devam kamsa chanuramardanam devaki paramanandam krishnam vande jagadguru
shri krishna bhagwan ki
jai
shri prabhupad ki
jai
gaur bhaktan ki
jai
gaur So if you have any questions, we can discuss during Prasadam. Prasadam ready? Okay, any questions? Yes, Amit.
Guruji, many times Krishna go for everything, like in Kshatriya times there should be marriages between cousins and that should be regarding both of them.
Generally, marriage should not be with the same gotra. But when Krishna comes, Krishna by his omnipotence can neutralize these material influences. So these material influences don't apply to Krishna or his immediate associates. That's why there can be marriages like that. Especially when, even when, the, generally when the gotra is not the same, but even when the gotra is the same, because Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead and he is the in charge of all, above all these gotras. So they don't influence when Krishna is directly involved.
Yes, like once I heard that Kali Yuga actually begins from the time when then Shamidrishi had first like that first started as soon as to Parikshit Maharaj. So was it the same time when Krishna left?
See, how it is that the moment Krishna left, Kali Yuga started. The personality of Kali came to this world. Kali is also a person, Kali is also like a demigod. He has his own post. And he has a service of providing facilities for demoniac enjoyment for those souls who are rebellious of Krishna. So, in Kali Yuga, those souls, sometimes when you filter liquid, sometimes the gross dirt comes out first, the subtle dirt comes out. What remains is pure. But with respect to the yugas, it's the opposite. The purest souls, they go back in Satyuga. What remains goes back in Trita Yuga. What remains goes back in Dwapara Yuga. So those souls who are the most dirty, you know, those who could not pass through the filters of time and mercy, they refuse remnants from all the other yugas, they come in Kali Yuga. So, and we consider modern science teaching, modern yuga teaching that we are the most progressive of all ages. It's just an indication of the great false ego that we have. But for those souls, Kali provided this facility. So as soon as Krishna left, Kali Yuga officially started. But as long as Parikshit Maharaj was the king, although Kali was there in the kingdom, Kali had no influence. So it was that by Parikshit Maharaj's virtuous rule, he could keep Kali in check. But when Parikshit Maharaj got Kali off, Kali got Parikshit Maharaj off the scene through Sringi, then Kali Yuga took control, or rather Kali took control. So that means Kali Yuga started officially from that time, but Parikshit checked the influence of Kali during his own. Yes.
Really, in this teachings of Lord Chaitanya, there is like written Vatsalya Ras when it is there, and then this awe and veneration is not there.
Correct.
But then again, when you see this, the relationship of Devaki and Vasudev with Lord Krishna, there is a vatsalya ras, but there is all veneration because of which the love that Yashoda Mai and Nanda Maharaj we are giving to Lord, or like Lord is completely dependent upon Yashoda Mai and Nanda Maharaj, but here it's not like that. So
Bhakti Samad Sindhu explains the same thing with another example. It's like Arjuna is also Sakha of Krishna, and Sudama, Madhumangal, Stoka Krishna, Ruthapa, Devaprastha, all these are also Sakha of Krishna. But what is the difference? He says Arjuna's relationship with Krishna is called as Gaurav Sakhi, and Sudama and their relationship is called as Vishrambha Sakhi. Gaurav means, although in general, in Sakya, there is friendship. But a friendship is also with some awe and reverence. Because, of course, there is some awe and reverence which we see when Arjuna sees the Vishwarupa of Krishna. Sakheti matva prasabham yaduttam. Hey Krishna hai yadave sakheti. Maya janata mahinam tavedam. So Krishna, Arjuna says, my dear Lord, please forgive me. But not knowing your glory, ajanata mahimanam taveva. Ajanata, not knowing mahima, not knowing the mahima, what happened? I joke with you and call you, hey Krishna, hey Sakheti, please forgive me. So that is of course one time when Arjuna's Sakya bhava completely gets overshadowed by his awareness of Krishna's glory, his aishwarya. But in general, although Krishna and Arjuna are intimate, that is more the intimacy of princes or kings. Whereas the intimacy of Sudama with Krishna is the intimacy of Gopa boys. It's much closer. That's why Krishna and Arjuna is Gaurav Sakya. Means Sakya is respected. Whereas Sudama and Krishna relationship is Vishrambha Sakya. Vishrambha means very intimate. So like that, the relationship of Devaki and Vasudeva with Krishna is something like Gaurav Vatsalya. It's Vatsalya but with some awareness of Krishna's greatness. Yashoda Mai and Krishna, Yashoda Mai and Nanda Maharaj, even when others tell them that he is God, still temporarily they may realize it, then they will forget it. That's how there is more intimacy, surely in Vrindavan. That's why it is said that Krishna in Dwarka is perfect, Krishna in Mathura is more perfect, and Krishna in Vrindavan is most perfect. So, Aradhyo Bhagwan Prajeshatanas. So there are many forms of God, but Chaitanya Mahaprabhu showed that the most worshipable form of God is Krishna as Vrajesh and as Vrajesh. So Vrajesh is Nanda Maharaj, Tanaya is the son. So when Krishna appears Vrajendra Nandana, Vrajesh Tanaya, that is our worshipable God. Taddhama Vrindavanam, the most worshipable abode for us is Vrindavan. Ramya Kachida Upasana Vrajavadhu Vargena Vartampita. Nobody can worship Krishna in a way better than what the gopis are worshipping. Sarva Dharman, which gave up everything to Krishna's sake. And all this we learn from there, Srimad Bhagavatam Pramana Mamata. All the topmost among all scriptures, Srimad Bhagavatam. And Prema Kumartho Mahan. The ultimate goal of life is not moksha, it is Prema. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu Matamidam Patra Dharana Para. This is the pin of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Because he is the Supreme Lord, there is nothing higher than this. These are the five highest things for us. So that's a Vrindavan is the highest, Vishnu Mahi Lavi Dosa the highest. Yes,
sir. Krishna performed pastime of childhood in this on earth only. So this childhood pastime also go on eternally in future.
Krishna's age is 15. So the childhood pastimes, for example, Krishna growing up happens only in the material world. In the spiritual world, Krishna is eternally of the same age. But although he is Krishna of Kaishore age, he appears like a child. Mother Yashoda. But the pastimes of growing are not there. So, the childhood pastimes are there in the sense that as a child, Krishna reciprocates love with his devotees. Mother Yashoda and the Maharaj. But as Krishna is small, he is born, Krishna's birth is not there in the spiritual world. Like Krishna is taking his first steps, Krishna walking, all these things are not there. But as a child, the rasa of Vatsalya is there in the spiritual world. Okay, by the yoga maya potency, Krishna arranges all this.
Through this material world, Krishna allows time to some extent. He allows time to be the
himself to be controlled by time to some extent. Till youthful is.
Whatever he wants. He doesn't grow beyond youth. That's true. So whenever Krishna wants, he allows time. In one sense you can say that if Krishna appeared in this year and left in this year. And that means Krishna becomes just like another personality. You know, he had a date when he appeared and a date when it disappeared. So in that sense, whenever anybody comes in the material world, to some extent, that person we can say comes into the realm of matter. But that is by his choice. And Krishna is never under the realm of matter, because whenever he wants, he can expand time. Yes?
Among the Muslims, they follow a religious system called philosophy called jihad, in which they, for the sake of religion, they can kill or they can do merciless killing of anybody. But they follow that if somebody comes in the path of religion, then they can kill or they can do anything. So is that in connection with Quran? What's the philosophy in Quran? Prophet Muhammad, when came, he was also the messenger of Lord. So how has the philosophy been?
Whenever prasadam is ready, you let me know that we should not delay devotees. Okay? Then we will continue the question answers by taking prasadam. So, Prabhupada appreciated Christianity, Islam, because they accept one God and they accept going to the kingdom of God as the ultimate goal of life. And he said, maybe one article he left with Muhammad is Hazrat Muhammad. He came to raise God consciousness. Now, like Prabhupada said, Jesus is the son of God. Prabhupada did not exactly said that Muhammad was the messenger of God. But he said, according to time, place, circumstance, he tried to raise the consciousness of people. And in that sense, we can say that he is doing the work of God. However, if we look at first the Islamic history and then we look at Prophet Muhammad's history, life history also, it is largely a history of violence. During his life himself, he fought a lot of wars. And at times, during the wars also, there was deception that was used. And the deception was considered fakr, they call it. That is the grace of God. So, what they call it, deception being used in service of truth. Something like that. So, since then, see, taking his example, the Muslim rulers have been quite barbaric and they have wreaked a lot of devastation. Now, in their religion, they have the term kafir. Kafir means anybody who does not accept Allah as God and accepts Muhammad as the topmost, as the best, and the last prophet of God. They are the Baha'is who accept Prophet as a God, but they accept their leader as a later prophet. And that's why the Muslims are dead against them, and they consider even them to be kafirs. So, now the idea of kafir is a hotly debated idea. If you go to peace conferences, the Muslims will quote, the Quran has two parts. Basically, Muhammad lived in Mecca. At the age of 40, he went into a trance. And then, he had gone on top of a mountain. And there it is said, according to Islamic tradition, that the archangel Gabriel, he came to Muhammad and told him, write. But Muhammad was illiterate. He said, I don't know how to write. Write! And he said, I don't know how to write. He said, write! And then his hand moved by mystical person. He started writing. Something like that. And then, from that time onward, he started getting revelations. So, whenever he would get revelations, he would tell his followers, write this down. And they would write it down. So when initially he got revelations at Mecca, none of the relatives or family members or immediate friends of Muhammad accepted them as revelations. So he was angry with them and he left Mecca. He had to flee from Mecca, he went to Medina. So the Meccan revelations are quite soft-like. And they're about tolerance, brotherhood, friendship. So if you go to any peace conference where Muslims are there, I often go to peace conferences, they will quote from the one verse from the Meccan Quran. So the Quran has two parts. The revelations which were there in Mecca are called Meccan. And the revelations which were there in Medina are called the Medinan Quran. So they will always quote this verse. In religion, there shall be no force. Mm-hmm. That's the verse that they quote. That Islam is a religion of tolerance. But in the Medinan Quran, the revelations are much more hardline. And there in 9.4, there is the verse of the sword, which they use. it is kill the kafirs wherever you see them. So, and in the Islamic tradition, because the Medinan revelation was later, so their understanding is that if the later, all the revelations are authoritative, but if the later revelation, the earlier revelation contradict, the later revelation is to be considered superior. So, actually the mullahs in their mosques, they will always talk the later revelation, and the kafir should be killed. And in the peace conferences, they will portray that actually Islam is a religion of tolerance. So, we as devotees, we appreciate God consciousness wherever it is there. And we have to appreciate that Islam has made people God conscious to some extent. You know, many Muslims do namaz very regularly and they have some faith in God through that. At the same time, the overall trend has been very aggressive. So the way Islam has been, and it has largely grown from the life of Muhammad Prophet, that it is more it is a religion which is more a quest for political power than a quest for spiritual truth. Now Islam, you know, they don't have any celibates. They don't have any people abstaining from worldly pleasures. Prophet Muhammad himself had many wives. In fact, he married one girl when she was 6 years old, and he united with her when she was 11 or something like that. That's the story. And she became one of the later readers. She was, Aisha was her name. So, his life was not like what we would call a sadhu in Vedic tradition, or not even what like we would call a saint in the Christian tradition. So, he was himself a political ruler. Beyond that, the meaning of the word kafir, so that verse is clearly there. Now, there's one more thing which Airavatpur mentioned in his book. That there are incidents, at least one incident documented, when Muhammad said, there was a revelation, he said, write it down. And then, afterwards he said, oh, that is not God's revelation, that is the devil's revelation. The devil had come to me. So, and he told, cancel this revelation. So now, actually, the Quran was not written down till almost 50-60 years after the Prophet departed. And Muhammad had told Ali to be his successor. So, Ali was supposed to be the next caliph, they call it. But there were other people who were, Ali was like his cousin or something like that. The other people were more power hungry. And while Ali was performing the final rites of Muhammad, they declared somebody else to be the caliph. So, 2-3 people, afterwards, Ali eventually became the caliph. And by that time, he was quite old, he lived for a very short time. So, the teachings that Ali has given are very, very tolerant. And Ali was the person who was the closest to the Prophet. So if you look at Ali's teachings, they are very, very tolerant and broad-minded. But the teachings we get in the Quran now, because the Quran was written 40 years afterwards, so there may be some verses which have been got added also. They are either the devil's revelation or their verses added later. Of course, no Muslim will accept that any verse has been added afterwards. They say the Quran not changed at all. But as of now, there are verses in the Quran which are quite heavy against not those who don't follow Islam. Now, again, the meaning of kafir is debated. If you go to peace conferences, they will say the word kafir means that those who oppose, if somebody opposes you in your practice of devotion to God, then he's a kafir and he should be fought at that time. And Islamic scholars will also say that actually the kafir also means an inner war. You know, within all of us, there's a tendency to disobey God. The fight against the tension, and when it's in concept, conquer that tension. So among them, there are Shias and Sunnis. So they also have their own debates about what is right and what is wrong. So anyway, so kafir, from the point of view of the broad-minded Muslims, which from our point of view, we will see the best part of other religions, the most God-conscious parts. So we will consider that part to be the actual revelation. So the jihad means the inner fight against the lower tendencies. Kafir means the person who opposes us in our practice of religion. But historically, that is not the way Islam has been practiced. And that we could say is the mistake of the Islamic leaders or whatever. So as devotees, you know, we want to encourage God consciousness wherever we see it. And therefore, we appreciate if a Muslim practices devotion to God in whatever way he is practicing. At the same time, we also have to be cautious, because they just don't have any concept of deity worship. Because at that time, many false gods were being worshipped. And when Muhammad reconquered Mecca, at that time there was a Kaaba. Kaaba was it's a long history, but Kaaba is considered a sacred place. And there are many idols being worshipped over there. So Muhammad went and smashed all the idols. Personally, he smashed all the idols along with his followers. Now, of course, there's one thing. There was a picture of Jesus and Mary. He said, "Don't tear that." He said, "Remove it, but don't tear it. Don't harm it." That means even the Prophet's actions, there is the indication that there can be some sacred form which need not be desecrated, desecrated. Desecrated means vandalized or destroyed. But so they consider, they don't, that is not highlighted in their religion. And their idea is that God is so holy and so pure, and matter is so unholy, so filthy and so contaminated, that there can be no contact between God and matter. The only contact is the Quran. So they consider all deities to be idols. And because they consider the deities to be false gods, so therefore, whenever the Muslim rulers would conquer India, one of the first things they would do is they would destroy the temples. And that's why we know, if you come to Vrindavan, many of the original deities from Vrindavan are now in Jaipur, because Jaipur was ruled by Rajputs. So they protected the deities. So historically, Islam has been a religion of intolerance, and it has been a religion of violence against other religions. And that's how many of the Muslims are brainwashed into believing. But ultimately, we understand that every soul is a part of God. And God can give many ways by which He can manifest Himself to us. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, very beautiful, it's a long prayer, I'll paraphrase it, long thought. He says that, "My dear Lord, when I see you, when I see somebody worshipping you in a form different from..." When I see you being worshipped in a form different from what I am accustomed to, by a ritual that is different from what I am accustomed to, you know, I am amazed at how much merciful you are. That you have appeared in this form to this person to accept his worship. And seeing your mercifulness, my devotion to the form that I worship is increasing. How merciful is my Lord? So if we see a Muslim offering prayer, namaz in the train, or congregating on time to offer the namaz, you know, we can appreciate that discipline which is there. So one time Prabhupada was in Iran, and at that time the devotees, they were discussing, and at that time this Allah Akbar, their prayers there, namaz prayer, loudly started. And Prabhupada closed his eyes, he became very meditative, completely absorbed. And completely silent throughout the full prayer. And when the prayer got over, Prabhupada opened his eyes were thriving. Wasn't that beautiful? So then the devotee said, "Prabhupada, wouldn't it be better if they chant Hare Krishna?" So Prabhupada looked almost pained and said, "Why are you making me sectarian? Why are you making me sectarian?" That means Prabhupada was very broad-minded. So at whatever level people appreciate and worship God, we respect that, we appreciate that, we recommend that to them. But we understand that Krishna has revealed in much higher and richer forms, and we worship that. And at a practical level, if we face threats, we have to protect ourselves. At the same time, we don't have to be hate mongers. We don't have to criticize and oppose unless it is necessary. So we appreciate God consciousness wherever it is. Now Prabhupada's policy was, if he met some, whenever he would meet some Christians, if they were nominal Christians means just naam ke vaste Christians, more than a Christian family. Like most of us were nominal Hindus. We're not practicing any Hindu religion at all. So if they were nominal Hindus, like Satyaraj Prabhu has one incident in his life, and he was from a Jew family before. So when he became a devotee, then there was family get together. And he was telling his family members about Krishna consciousness. So his uncle said, his uncle was known to be atheist. He said, Are you trying to convert me? So, Satyaraj was also very intelligent. I didn't know that you belong to any religion. I'm a Jew. Of course, I'm an atheist, but I'm a Jew atheist. Now, this has no meaning, isn't it? A Jew atheist, a Jew is one who follows the commandments of Moses. And 10 commandments are all related to God. Thou shalt love God with all thy heart, all thy mind, and all thy might. One of the most important commandments. The most important, not one of the most important. And Moses was asked the most important commandment, he said this one. And Jesus was asked, this is the most important commandment. So how can there be a Jew atheist? It has no meaning. So what does this mean? This means religion has become another bodily designation. So if it becomes the bodily designation, then it just becomes a part of the false ego. The purpose of religion is to cut through the false ego to actually bring out the soul's natural God consciousness. But unfortunately, when there is not proper philosophical education, then religion becomes another part of the false ego. And then when people are fighting, they're not fighting because of religion, they're fighting because of false ego. And false ego can lead them to fight because of race, it can lead them to fight because of nationality, it can lead them to fight because of money, ultimately it's money and power. So religion can also be one of the guards. So as devotees, we understand that there are different ways to raise God consciousness. So somebody was a nominal Christian, Prabhupada would tell them that actually Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mercy is unparalleled and this is the fastest way to raise God consciousness, raise your Krishna consciousness. And he would inspire them to become Krishna devotees. But if somebody would be a devout Christian, for example, there was a Christian priest, when Prabhupada would talk with them, he would not tell them to convert. He would say that you have dedicated your life to Jesus, at least follow Jesus now. Jesus said, thou shalt not kill. Stop eating meat. You follow Jesus properly. Prabhupada would say, if you read Bhagavad Gita, you will become a better Christian. You understand the universal principles of God consciousness. So the teachings of reincarnation, of karma, of the kingdom of God are much more better dealing in the Vedic literature. So in that sense, we are not sectarian. Ultimately, the soul is neither Hindu nor Muslim. The soul is a part of God, a devotee of God. And whatever ways Krishna has offered for souls to get elevated, we appreciate and respect that. But we also understand that by Krishna's inconceivable mercy, we have come to a path where the revelation is the clearest and the highest. So we have to protect this revelation. And if we can, we attract other people to this revelation. If we cannot, then we have to protect at least those who are practicing it. And others, at whatever level they are practicing, they can practice.
Because the ultimate goal of God consciousness is to develop love and affection, not to become violent and not to become, means not to force some religious philosophy on something. So the philosophy of Muslims is that whatever religious philosophy they are following, believing on Allah and this, they are ultimately leading to violence and ultimately leading to rights between they are creating, means they do not develop love or they are more degraded. So that's not the goal of any, means although they are following.
Well, with all due respects to Hinduism, see, you know, Hinduism is also not much better. Hinduism may not have led to violence, but it has led to sentimentality. So how much is Hinduism leading to love for God? We have Visa Ganesh. That may not be leading to violence to others. So basically, we should see, understand that Hinduism and Islam are two brands of Maya. So Islam may be a little more violent brand of Maya, and Hinduism may be a little more tolerant brand of Maya. But both are Maya. And we are not battling Islam. We are battling Maya. So when Muslims are being violent, it is not that they are Muslims violent, they are puppets in the hands of Maya who is making them violent. What makes people violent is the modes of passion and ignorance. See, you know, we should not divide people by their designation. We have to have a philosophical vision. So yes, the history of Islam may be such that people are more passionate and more violent in that. And the history of Hinduism may be where people are more tolerant. That's okay. But we have to see the philosophical vision that ultimately we are countering Maya. And of course, if Maya is coming in particular forms which are threatening, then we have to accept that. Now, in Islam also there are Sufi saints who were very devout. So, there are exceptions also. But transcendentalism is not a focus in Islam, at least as it is practiced today. So, thank you very much. Hare Krishna.
Krishna.